what in our pronouncements I should make. So not only are we becoming increasingly marginalized and irrelevant to the Shema on behalf of the community, behalf of the committee and the departments that are here and the NGOs that represent millions and millions of people, I will convey our condolences is too strong a word. What shall I say? Convey our good wishes to our regret. Although, when I get a flu, you must always condole with me in such a way. Because I really feel like, hey, but it's so unnecessary and I'm dying. And will I ever recover? And then to my astonishment, 5 days later, having read two novels, I actually have recovered. Okay. So here we are. We're going to apologize, express our concern about Dolly's state of health. And tell her she must stay in bed until she has to come. Comrade Meruti is booked off from today until Friday. I knew she had to go and see a doctor, so we wish her well too, and I shall phone her to do so. Carol reminds me that on the program, those of you are here for that reason, the jurisdiction of regional courts bill, we were going to vote on it today, but for two reasons we're not going to vote on it. One is, having received Joas's submission yesterday, we need to apply our minds. We also need to confer outside of the committee processes, or outside the formal processes, to actually bring them on board a bit more, make them feel that they, have a vital role to play and their views have to be taken into account and so on. Because, they do represent 1,300 members of the magistrate fraternity, and we're trying to, not take them seriously. So we will attend to that, myself in particular, and JB. Is JB here? JB's not here. All right, JB and I will attend to that. So we'll vote on it sometime next week. It's up for debate in the House on the 9th of May, so that's not a problem. Then thirdly, Carol reminds me that tomorrow we have the mandating procedures of provinces bill, which I must say, Carol, you chaired and completed with enormous aplomb. In fact, there are more changes, pages of changes, and unlike others here, we number our pages, of amendments that's longer than the actual bill is. And the bill is a mere 2 pages, is that right?
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah. So anyway, and in fact what's very good is everybody agrees with those changes. So we must thank Carol for her excellent work. Then is there anything else, Carol, you think I should say?
JJ's arrived.
Okay. JJ the coward has arrived. By the way, before I finish, and I assure you this is the last thing I'm going to say, I want all of you, in the interest of transparency and openness, to know, and I'm accountable to this committee, Steve Swart, that on Friday and Sunday last, on the quarter to five flight, SA621, one John Jeffrey of this very committee was seated in the same plane as I was. While I was coursing through this Lawrence Bassett bill and trying to understand whether it's written in English or Latin, teasing you, Lawrence, and looking at the submissions from the NGOs and saying, haven't I read this before 4 times? No, I couldn't tell. No. And turning over the next thing, saying, but I've read that already. Okay. John Jeffrey and Skelton was reading Superman comics and Batman comics and smiling at me and ordering a third whiskey, Mama Shah. Moreover, what the question I think we should ask him, Carol, why was he not reading Batwoman? Where was the gender sensitive? Where was Bat Supergirl or Superwoman, she's telling today? That's John Jeffrey, the co-chair of this committee. I leave this committee to decide on what to make of it.
There's a principle that we believe in, as you sow, you will reap. And it's very interesting that a certain John Jeffries used to give another member of this committee an incredibly hard time, continually. So I think he's reaping certain things.
Offensive. And some people here might see him.
Some people here might
be
even. The priest is
here. And let it be noted that I'm only supposed to chair when JJ is not here, and JJ is here, so you owe me. Okay, yeah, just for those who weren't here yesterday, just to remind people that we haven't been to our study group on this, so whatever we discuss today really is more of a workshop session and more of a brainstorming session. We still need to take it back to our respective parties, so we haven't got any firm positions on anything. We're really just throwing around individual ideas. And with that being said, over to Mr. Bassett. I think we're on page 4 of the L document.
Thank you, Chair.
Starting with the most contentious issue.
I think we were on
the
preliminary inquiry.
Okay, were we not finished with that?
And we decided that we'd leave it there for the time being. Perhaps before I actually start, Chair, is just to mention you, or you requested that we try and get the PNG minutes. We've got a set here, we've copied a set, and we'll give it to, I'm not too sure who we give it to if Lolly's not here. Okay. That's right. What I can perhaps mention, we had a look there. I undertook yesterday, because there was I wasn't too certain about what the committee had deliberated on as far as the preliminary inquiry is concerned, and I can just report back that the minutes of, I'm not too sure what date, but anyway, on two places in the minutes, it was indeed the committee decided that the preliminary inquiry should only be relevant where in respect of the offences that were qualified for diversion. So I'm just mentioning that by way of starting. But the minutes are here, and then there will be two members. Most of the comments, again, like for assessment and for the preliminary inquiry, go back to the heart of the problem. And most of the comments were saying that all children should qualify to be considered for diversion, and that the bill excludes certain children from the possibility of diversion based on age and based on the offence committed. That is the nub of the comments in this regard, saying that this is unfair, it's discriminatory because adults don't that is not the way adults are treated. Let me just have a look and see what else. There are some more smaller suggestions. Those are more of a technical nature. One of the other comments that was received was that the duration of the child's attendance at a diversion program should be determined by the child's need for assistance and rehabilitation, and it was suggested that the prescribed period in the bill, I think it's 12 months and 24 months for level ones or level two diversion options, might be too brief, and that we could possibly consider, this is more on a technical level, could consider not prescribing a maximum period for diversion programs, but prescribing a minimum period. If I go closer, will that, does that help? It's going to be...
Yeah, but they're not defending your back.
I'm just having a look at the Legal Aid Board also. Was a bit concerned about the whole question, and if I understand their comments correctly, were saying that they were worried about, and they mentioned that yesterday as well, about the child's admitting guilt, or being, you know, acknowledging responsibility and the possibility of the child acknowledging responsibility purely to escape the formal criminal justice system. Another issue that was raised, diversion should not be treated as a criminal offense and used in future criminal matters during sentencing in particular. The bill should also be modified to state clearly that a child can be diverted more than once. There was also under diversion generally, but I presume we'll deal with it more specifically when we get to Clause 57. Under diversion generally, however, RAFCAN said that Clause 57 should be deleted. That is the diversion of certain sexual offences cases where the offender is below 14 years. Also under the broad comment that, you know, everybody should be able to qualify for the consideration of diversion. The Child Justice Alliance driver group also mentioned that the exclusion of certain children from diversion based on their age could be in contravention of Section 179(2) of the Constitution. That's dealing with the prosecution's prerogative to institute prosecutions on behalf of the state. Disallowing diversion for certain children will result in a disproportionate situation, as diversion for adults is not limited, as I've already mentioned. I think I've covered in broad terms everything that was said under diversion as a general aspect and not being dealt with, because diversion also crops up quite often when we go through the bill on a clause by clause basis.
Maybe just for clarity, if anybody, yeah, Mr. Bassett, Dr. Skelton, Jackie, anybody, just tell the committee what presently can adults be diverted irrespective of offence. In other words, can adults be diverted for rape and murder offences? And secondly, is it correct that at the moment, in terms of current prosecutorial practice, all children are eligible, are considered for diversion? Just clarify that for us.
Chair, I'd like to confer with my colleagues. As far as adults are concerned, I don't think there is any legislation in place saying what dealing with diversion at all, and it's dealt with by the prosecutor. The second... at the moment, the prosecutor, prosecution's policy directives, I think, that are issued under, I think it's what, Section 179 of the Constitution, say that it is an inappropriate to divert certain matters, and I think murder, rape, and some other serious offences are mentioned there specifically. I'll ask Lorette just to...
Yeah, if I could just add on there that it's specifically in the MPA guidelines, and it's under Chapter or Part 7 that they say, diversion is inappropriate where the charge is one of murder, robbery with aggravating circumstances, rape, or a similarly serious offence. Offenders with a criminal record and persons to whom the opportunity has been granted previously should only be included in exceptional circumstances in diversion. So that links onto both the issue of the seriousness of the crime and the fact that you've previously been diverted, that should be taken into account as to whether or not to divert you in future. The same can be said of the most recent guidelines brought out under the Sexual Offences Bill, specifically for the child offender. It says, in deciding whether or not to prosecute, including diversion, a child offender regard should be added to the following factors: the seriousness of the offense, the age and apparent maturity and mental capacity of the child offender, the availability of alternatives to prosecution, the sentencing options available to the trial court, and the child offender's family circumstances, etc. The point to be made here that it's not unlimited at the moment. They have to, and especially they say diversion is inappropriate. So this is for both adults and children under the general guidelines of the MPA. And this flows from the policy, and the policy is made in consultation with the Minister of Justice, where the Minister has a veto power on it.
Could I just add that one must not take this out of context of the whole principles of restorative justice? And when the first Child Justice Bill came about, restorative justice was quite a new phenomenon. And that is why initially the definition had not been amplified to the extent that it probably is today. Since that period of time, there's been a whole range of processes, and diversion is one very small component of the entire principles of restorative justice. So while once one wants to look at the issues of accountability and ensure that people get the right types of treatment, nothing stops them from having to, if it's a very heinous crime, even in spite of what the diversion prescripts of the NPA would say, you could still go through your trial and through the non-custodial programs still get the kind of rehabilitation where there is, for lack of a better term, that sexual deviancy issue that needs to be managed. And I think when the bill came out, we had not provided the kind of options, and there still are very limited options in the current Criminal Procedure Act. What the main one is custodial sanctions. We did not have the other types of programs from service providers to enable accountability with the sentence and a non-custodial sanction to remedy whatever offending behavior there is. Today, there are a whole range of those. So I think it cannot be taken in isolation from the way it was drafted at the time.
Thank you, Chair. From the civil society's point of view, is that obviously we know that at the moment every child is eligible for diversion, subject, of course, to the NPA guidelines. But the point is that they still remain guidelines. And if there is a meritorious case where in one particular instance a child would benefit from diversion, dialogue can always be opened with the NPA about diverting that particular child. To legislate against excluding that is our fear, because it might just exclude some certain exceptional cases. But maybe I could hand over to Maggie from the NPA.
Thank you, Chair. I wish to agree with my colleagues in the Department of Justice that according to the NPA guidelines, we have a criteria where we do guide our prosecutors on how to select cases for diversion. But if you read our guidelines, it says there are cases which cannot be diverted. It's murder, robbery, and rape. But since those guidelines were developed in 1999, we wanted to amend the guidelines, but we're waiting for the bill to make necessary amendment. Because as Sherine correctly said, with the development and restorative justice, we do divert now some sexual offences cases, though we do not have a program around the country for sexual offences. And our policy guidelines, they said rape cannot be diverted, but in certain instances, we feel that a child of 10 years who have committed sexual offences, we do divert those cases. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Thanks. I was hoping to get in before Maggie, so that she could also respond, but anyway, you need to... I think the issue for me is we've been exploring it, but maybe just to try and hone in more, what is the existing case and for everybody, and why do we want to be different? So, okay, we're told there's no legislative restrictions. I mean, if I can just try and summarize something, and you can then tell me if I'm correct. There's no legislative restriction. There are prosecutorial guidelines, which are presumably just that, guidelines. The wording of those guidelines, according to certain categories, is inappropriate. I mean, the words that I took down were inappropriate and except in exceptional circumstances. So even within those guidelines, inappropriate is not saying that it is never to be done. It's not a good idea is what inappropriate is saying. It's not really appropriate. And exceptional circumstances mean, except in exceptional circumstances, mean that it could be done. There could be exceptional circumstances. So as far as I see it, then, the prosecutorial guidelines are not preventing the diversion of any case.
They're strongly recommending against certain cases, but they're not preventing, as with the words inappropriate and exceptional circumstances. So if that is the case, why do we want to ban or to restrict diversion as an option? Even if it's an outside 1% chance. I mean, look, personally, I think, yeah, I mean, maybe with sexual offences you could look at whether a child's capacity as far as sexual offences is you know, this, well, the same as an adult, particularly with sexual issues, appreciation, those kinds of questions. Personally, I would think with a murder, you know, I would have problems with a diversion of a murder. But do we want to ban it? Do we want to rule it out? And I suppose then the question to the department and also to the NPA would be, why do we, well, I suppose NPA would be, you know, what's your comment more, but the department would be, why do we want to be so absolute that where there isn't absolution anywhere else, even in the guidelines? Why do we not want to just leave it up to the guidelines as it is the case? I suppose the issue to the NPA may be a fear of these overworked prosecutors wanting to divert more easily so that they can reduce their workload. So maybe the NPA has a interest in having diversion. But I think the question for me is the, sorry, I'm sorry for going on, I can see your co-chair is looking bored.
No, not at all.
What is the existing law at the moment? And am I correct that there's no restriction? The only restriction is a guideline which is not absolute. So if that is the case, why do we want to with children, Nochal, exclude?
Actually, I think
that's a really good question. Yeah, that's exactly the point. Do you want to cast it in stone in legislation? As it seems like we're taking a step backwards as from where we are at the moment or what we're doing at the moment.
And why?
And why? If the department can just, I mean, then, you know, if you've got an argument for it, then by all means.
Can I tell you what?
And actually, we want to ask you why you
did this.
Thank you, Chair. You're quite correct. And perhaps I should go back to what the debates were in 2002.
Haven't they got a video recording that we can play at home on a Sunday, that our families can be cast aside and we can slap it onto our TV screens and say, yeah, well, that's what your work was required here.
But seriously, Chair, this was debated at length by the committee, and I've mentioned on a number of occasions during these deliberations, proportionality played a huge role. The rights of victims, the crime wave in the country, those are the issues that came up. I speak under correction, but I think it was also a question of prosecutors possibly not all being trained to deal with these things. You always there's that element as well. In a nutshell, that's what has been said on previous occasions. It was time. It was mentioned. The words we're using. It's time to draw a line between serious offences and less serious offences, which can be diverted, and the serious offences that can't be diverted. That is really what the debate was about.
I think those questions are important, but mine was sort of fundamentally, I mean, it may well be that we want to draw a line. We want to say murders cannot be diverted. Mm. But we haven't drawn that line. Murders can be diverted, inappropriate, and only in exceptional circumstances, but they can be. Why do we want to draw the line with children? Why do we not then say, okay, everybody? But to me, the inconsistency is this point. I think why is it harder on children than on the adult population? That's what worries me. If somebody comes with an argument to say, look, let's pass a law which says you cannot divert murders. Fine. We can debate that. But why pass a law which says you can divert murders for everybody else, for adults, but you can't divert the child murderers?
I have to be quite frank. You know, that is very difficult to answer. The only thing that I can think of, this is the first time that diversion is being dealt with in or being regulated by law. And I go back, I do not have an answer to Mr. Jeffrey's question.
Would a child murderer not have a constitutional case that they're being unequally treated because they're being restricted from having diversion considered, whereas an adult murderer can be, even though it's inappropriate and only under exception circumstances? I mean, to me, that just seems unequal.
Add on there, maybe. It really, the instruction came from the committee very clearly on this point, and I spoke to the previous chair, and she also emphasized that at that stage, it was that situation that Mr. Swart referred to yesterday, where if it was NICRO, whoever came at that stage, and one of their diversion programs were placed before the committee for sexual offenses, and the committee looked at it and found it very inept to send a child who committed a rape for 2 weeks, which amounted was a 6-week program, but the amount of hours the child spent on it amounted to 2 weeks. And the victim still lives in the same situation. I mean, we're talking about,
stop you on that. I mean, I think let's separate out the diversion program from the principle. Okay, we can legislate to say, the diversion program must follow certain criteria for particular offenses. So don't come with that as an argument about why you shouldn't divert. That's a separate.
Yeah, I had the same conversation with the previous chair, and apparently the decision in 2002 was taken on the basis of that you don't want a prosecutor to be able to divert because they want to get matters off their roll because their court roll may be full. That same thing about the content of diversion programs not being suitable for particularly offences of robbery, murder, and rape. And that from a sort of policy perspective, the committee members were uncomfortable. They thought that sending a message, well, that it sent an incorrect message that you have children who have committed, for example, rape, robbery, and murder, being diverted and therefore not having criminal records. And those were apparently the three main issues. But I completely buy the point that JJ is making, that you cannot, the principle of diversion and the content of a program is different. And also, that was the position in 2002. It's not to say that the content of programs today is exactly the same. So, yeah, Jackie had her hand up.
Thank you, Chair. And just, I mean, I'd like to thank Mr. Jeffries, because that's exactly the point that we tried to make on the principle of the matter. But just as far as the concerns that have been raised that relate to the concerns that were raised in 2002, and just possibly to update the committee, and I'm sure the Department of Social Development could speak to it more thoroughly than I could, is that since then there has been an extensive research program to develop minimum norms and standards relating to diversion. And those are very, very comprehensive, based on an extraordinary amount of research to ensure that whatever diversion program is offered is credible, and there's a certain, not only program content is of a particular nature, but that the organizational structure of the diversion service provider is also credible and viable. So that's the one thing. And just on the issue regarding, and maybe Maggie can also talk to that, is that the concern was that prosecutors could just use diversion to get matters off the court roll. If we have the preliminary inquiry, you will then have an oversight mechanism through the magistrate to say, well, hold on, you know, why are you just using diversion in this particular way? Whereas at present, you don't have that. It's purely a prosecutorial discretion with no other oversight because there's no legislation for it.
Before I get to Mr. Jeffrey, Mr. Swart had his hand up.
Yeah, I think that at that time, I think the point was made correctly. The whole concept of restorative justice was very new, and a lot of people were quite concerned, and that incident about the one program, and I think things have developed quite further.
obviously the crux is what JJ has pointed out. If the adults are entitled to it now, on what basis can we not at least afford the opportunity to be considered for that? Clearly, one will have to be aware of the public sentiment around it and how it is marketed. And I remember the headlines in the papers at that stage. Remember, it was apology for this and this. And there is apology, which that obviously created the impression soft on crime. But things have developed so much further. And if it is used in practice at the moment, I'm sure that at the moment children could be considered for diversion subject to the NPA's practice at the moment. So we need to be very aware. If necessary, we could build in a mechanism that it, in very serious cases, that it's only decided on at the high level, at DPG, at the Director of Public Prosecutions for very serious offences. You can put in that mechanism as well. We've done that in other cases. We did it in the sexual offences case where to prosecute, we would have to get the permission of the... So you could build in a mechanism that it is decided at a very high level where you've got those more serious offences. So I'm tending to go along with the idea that all children should be considered at least, but we need to be very careful how we phrase that in view of public sentiment around crime.
Yeah, I mean, maybe to the department first. Is there any legislation in the pipeline restricting, banning diversion for these other categories of crimes for everybody? And if then it was considered as so important, why? You know? Okay, I know you're going to throw it back to the committee, but this bill subsequently then has been back to the minister, back to cabinet. So that's one. The other then would be to the NPA. I mean, through you, Chair, to Maggie. What are the stats of diversion with regard to children at the moment for these categories of crimes that we are considering restricting? Have there been any diversions? I'm asking that. I mean, that's not particularly material, because I would imagine that the answer would be very few, if any. But I suppose it would respond to the issue of Mr. Swart's sort of concern about if we allow the possibility, are we being soft on crime? And I would then say, no, we're not, because we're not saying there should be. We just want to leave, as with adults, the outside possibility. But anyway, but I think it would be to then the NPA, to Maggie, have there been any cases of murders, of rapes, of firstly children and secondly adults that have been diverted?
Thank you, Chair. Currently, the stats we're collecting at NPA, it just indicates the number of children who have been diverted versus the number of adults who have been diverted. We don't have the statistics that indicate what sort of cases have been referred to diversion programs. But as far as I'm concerned, we know that there are limited cases for murder for children who have been diverted. And I'm not quite sure whether there are cases of diversion which are of murder who are sent for diversion by our prosecutors.
Okay, there have been some instances where the NICRO program, I think they've developed their program to a greater extent than 2002, and it's called the National Sex Offender Program for young children who have been diverted. But as Maggie says, those stats are not disaggregated. We would get those figures from NICRO itself. They don't use it predominantly as a custodial program, purely as a diversionary program. But it's also quite limited, and it depends on, if one can use that as a term, the nature of the offense, how heinous or what were the impacts at that particular time. That's the one part. The other part is in response to what's happening on restorative justice and diversion, and we're looking at it as a department as a whole. And I think I mentioned this before at this committee, that it's not just a question of looking at it from the perspective of diversion, but there have been so many developments countrywide, including looking at the traditional system of justice, some of which you will find incorporated when that bill comes before, just the whole policy of trying to coordinate it at a countrywide level, because the number of, and this is one of those few instances where the practice is now beginning.
Could have changed in some way, yeah. what I'm going to suggest is can't possibly expand. I mean, the arm will stay down there, but can't. I mean, I'm also worried about. I mean, there's a team from social media. None of them are at the table.
See, if I was chairing that meeting, I wouldn't have allowed.
No, I wouldn't have either.
No, we've got enough chairs.
Yeah.
I don't think I should carry the chairs with my bag. I can't remove the chairs. We're not going to use. Are we going to use that until much later?
What I was going to suggest is those people who are just who are not going to be participating but are just going to be writing.
Yeah.
Could they not take some of these empty chairs and those that then are
going
to be
adding? Yeah, those who got computers will need to have a face like our friend there. That's fine, you stay there. What we do is, look, why don't we have people also... Are we going to use the screen just now? So why can't people sit there? There's four places there at least we can get. So we're all part of this. I don't think anybody needs to have a second layer. Let's move your chairs there. There's four there. And one or two here. One there, that's fine. So, you know, then we can see your hands when they go up as well.
Just be careful for you there.
Can you imagine the activism of ethnic chauvinism and ethnic identity prevailing upon the law?
Are you trying to
sabotage
my response?
No. You think your politicians are capable of that?
Oh. I'd rather not say I'm an official. If I may proceed. And then what we're finding to be a mammoth task is this is the one instance where programs have mushroomed all over the country and trying to coordinate that and doing an audit at the moment so it can inform a national policy is where we are. That is quite important. But then building on the comment made by the previous honourable member and taking into account what we've done with the sexual offences legislation is there needs to be a great deal of training because restorative justice, if we're just trying to pull the kind of definition across from government departments and getting the principles of it, because even internationally the jurists and the authors don't agree on a common definition, pulling that together is proving quite a task, and more importantly is understanding it and having common standards and agreements for policies and protocols is quite a challenge. And in doing so, that impacts on the training. And what we found, and I think there was one instance where a matter of interest was diverted and the two parties sitting across the table and mediating. That is not acceptable considering that it was a dad and the daughter trying to mediate on a matter of incest. So one has to be very guarded. And the point made about training is very, very crucial in the management of it, and that's probably why at the time the committee said we need to have these programs at least be come to the committee to see how they would be managed. So in the same way that we've put the national directives for SAPS as an example and for NPA in the sexual offences, the amendment, I would think that's something that could be considered so that it's very managed and there's a continuous monitoring of it. Because that particular amendment came up with a very strong monitoring framework that has to be updated on an annual basis. So one can review the practice of it, especially with the training is prescribed. And beyond just training, what is prescribed in the national directions is the types of the components that must influence the training, which includes social context, understanding the concepts of child rights, and also understanding sexual deviancy and behavior by whichever officials are going to manage that program. So from the implementation point of view, that is very crucial as to how it's managed until we're all on par with this different system of justice that we're proposing through this bill. It's almost impossible at the moment just trying to coordinate it and also getting the right type of training across the country because it's still very loose.
While we're on the issue of content of diversion programs, would anybody be able to give us some information as to the problem that existed in 2002, whether content-wise, what Jackie referred to, the minimum norms and standards,
just so that we can, we'll be in a position to say, well, the position has improved since 2002. Just some detail as to what type of things are in the diversion program.
No, because I mean, the bill is quite strong on setting standards.
Yeah.
That's clause 54. So while I'm not saying we can't find out more, the problem around the appropriateness, I would have thought, has already been dealt with. So I'm just...
No, except that some people are arguing that what's happening in practice, although the standards are in the legislation, that in practice there are NGOs who can't provide...
Can I ask a question maybe for the department to respond?
It's, I suppose, maybe the sort of parting shot or whatever. But, I mean, we don't allow diversion for certain sexual offences. Last year we passed the Sexual Offences Act. Did we restrict diversion in that act at all? And, again, I think it's a major inconsistency on our part then, not yours, that, you know, we then have two laws in front of us. The one with children, we say, right, we're refusing to allow diversion. But then we've got a law before us where we actually can put it in for a particular group of offences, and we don't.
There's no restriction.
Dr. Skelton? Sorry, Mr. Bassett, let me just give Dr. Skelton a chance. Cause
so just on this one specific point, I also just want to point out to the committee that the Sexual Offences Bill makes it an offence for children below the age of 16 to have sexual intercourse, and that the defence of the three-year age difference doesn't apply. And at the moment then, if you look at section 56 of this bill, you would exclude those children from being diverted as well for consensual sexual behaviour.
Mr. Bassett, then Dr. Delport.
I really was just responding to the question that Mr. Jeffries raised. It wasn't answered about whether there is no legislation in the offing for adults as far as diversion is concerned. And that's something that if the committee feels that they want to proceed in the manner that in the Child Justice Bill, it might be appropriate also then to have a look at the situation of that.
Chairperson, I shouldn't speak because I've not been able to follow or be present. But really, we can't be inconsistent. We cannot put a child in a worse position than an adult. I really fail to see what arguments there could be offered at this stage to limit the diversion of children. There can be no argument in the light of our present legislation. Then the department or somebody must undertake a specific investigation covering children, covering adults, all of them, to limit diversion. But we can't go and do it here now on a small scale, tamper with none of the of the mechanisms of the law and not do a wholesale revision of diversion.
That's exactly my worry, is that my fear is that if you impose a tougher system on children than on adults, that the law would be, that this piece of legislation would be challengeable, because it looks like the legislature has arbitrarily applied its mind. It makes absolutely no sense to me.
I read this yesterday. I just find it very hard to believe that the 2002 committee would have, after considerable deliberation, not arrived at some of these decisions without quite substantial reasons. And the difficulty we have is Lawrence is required to speak on behalf of the committee. So I think maybe the three chairs should meet with the then chairperson reasonably soon. And just find out. I just find it hard to believe, really. I mean, then what really happened? You see, what's happening now, I mean, you know, let me switch this off. This is here. Outside it, I'll have to say this, okay? Okay. I don't care whether it's their right to be here. Let me word it carefully. You see, what is happening, it seems, is we had a bill which the executive brought, obviously, to Parliament before 2002 or thereabouts. Then what happened was the committee, after a considerable number of hours, changed that bill
and then referred it back to the executive. So now we've got an A version of the bill, and then 6 years later we've got a B version of the bill. Now what is happening is we're doing like a circle. From the B version we're going back to 2002. So in other words, the question at the horizon, why didn't we just adopt all these things in 2002, especially as half the people who are here were actually here then. So it'll be a very surrealistic process, really, and probably unique and unprecedented in the world of legislatures since the advent of democracy, that the bill comes, and then it's changed, it's brought back 6 years later, and it goes back to stage one. So what was the whole point of the 6 years intervening, and what happened? Now, we can rationalize the whole process and say 6 years later things have changed dramatically and so on. So I really think fairly soon, maybe the three co-chairs meet with the then chair. I really think, I mean, you know, the more I it's making me feel uneasy, JJ. Maybe you think, hey, this guy is being difficult, but my job is to chair also, not to be like a hack for the majority party. Although Bulalani might like that, but he's not here. And so I can speak more freely, which is all nonsense, because Bulalani is not really like that. And before people misunderstand, JJ was not reading Batman and Superman and so on. He was just reading Little Dot and Casper the Super Ghost. So is that clear? Okay. The point is, that worries me. So can't we be in a process, Carol, JJ, that we meet with Johnny, the Deputy Minister, reasonably soon?
Do you think that you need to appreciate that there have been developments?
Mm. Yeah, I'm coming to that.
And I think that is the key, that we need to identify those developments.
Yeah, I'm not convinced. That's what I'm about to come to the second.
Not only that, but there are other developments as well, such as case law. Now, while there's no legislative framework for diversion, there is case law. And there are review cases where prosecutors have been constrained to consider diversion in all cases. I think there was a full bench decision. So we need to get copies of that. That gives guidance. When were those decisions brought in? How has that influenced MPA policy? The MPA policy has been the programs. And also, one of our main concerns at that time was adults using children to commit offences. Since then, the Children's Bill has been Act, which makes it a statutory offence for adults to use children. The secondly, I think it's 94 something, makes it an aggravating circumstance for adults to use. That is a very strong factor of a concern that adults would use children if we divert all. So there are a number of factors that have developed since then.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that, but well, it's good you interrupted because you helped me. You see what I was going to say? I know what the answer is going to be. Things have changed dramatically since 2002. Well, let me say, I have the right to be skeptical. Firstly, your point is the principle of restorative justice and its application has advanced considerably. At that time, it was not a big issue. Then two points just made by Steve. Secondly, case law has developed, which has constrained people to divert. And thirdly, the concern then, which has also now been addressed 6 years later, is adults were using children, but this is now covered in the Children's Act, I think, etc. But when it comes to capacity, I am very cautious, both about the NPA and the Social Development Department. I'm too old now in this parliament not to be. It'll be irresponsible, really, for a chair of a committee, or since we are co-chairs not to do that. Irresponsible. I find it hard to believe because of the sweeping nature of the replies we get. And the fourth point I want to make is that at that time, this committee was under pressure because of the public. Well, haven't things got worse? Isn't the public even more concerned about crime now than before? So that even a certain ANC leader every now and then has to say, well, you know, let's have a referendum or let's have a debate. Well, I did say referendum. Actually, what I meant was debate. And, you know, while this is a policy, well, you know. So, I mean, let's be frank. We are probably under more pressure now than then. But finally, as it is with the death penalty, as it is with gay rights, as it is with abortion law, as far as the majority party concerned, we are a national democratic movement. And that means that certain values and principles apply to us. We cannot use the lowest common denominator amongst our rank and file to decide policy. I know, what's the point of having a referendum on the death penalty? I mean, why waste money? I can tell you now. You want to know? Well, maybe Bulalani knows better than me because he understands the majority better. Well, maybe he does. Not so sure. It doesn't mean that because I don't speak isiZulu, I don't understand human beings. But let's leave that aside. The fact of the matter is at least 90%, if not more of the people, I suspect even more, will say no. They don't want the death penalty abolished. On gay rights, you can imagine how high it would shoot. On abortion. So I don't think we need to be apologetic about certain things. Otherwise, we might as well just be a populist party. In other words, we don't have any policies. Let's ask the masses to decide everything. Okay? Now, the fact of the matter is, I really am not convinced, JJ. Where's JJ? I'm really not convinced, actually, that the developments that have occurred in the last 6 years are as dramatic as people are making out. Well, Steve says, can you give us the stuff on case law, department? That we have developed diversion now in case law, so it's happening already. Can you refer us to the relevant sections for those of us not familiar with the Children's Act? Then we agreed yesterday, in the absence of Dr. Delport, that we will have the Department of Social Development spell out exactly what you are doing in terms of providing assessment for all. You will also give us a provincial breakdown, because we spoke to a very, a member of the executive yesterday. And he said, which is something JJ picked up, you see, the Department of Social Development will come here and say, we can do it. But what they do, they're speaking on behalf of the national sphere. What is happening in the provinces, on the other hand, we don't know. So we would like you to prove to us that you can do it. And let me be utterly clear, speaking for myself and probably the majority in the portfolio committee, being the majority party, we want assessment for all. Yesterday's study group, I want to tell you, nothing to hide. We've agreed on it. We've agreed one person may have reservations, fine. The rest of us, we are saying we're having assessment for all. The only basis on which we will take a final decision on it will be the agreement, as I understand it, Bulalani yesterday was, yes to assessment for all, that is the ANC policy. Provided the Department of Social Development and the NPA give us the evidence that it can be done. So that's our policy, we're not discussing it further. Provided they can prove to us. And if need be, I'd like to suggest to the study group and the portfolio committee, if they want to join us, we go and actually do some inspections in local. We go and visit and see whether these things are happening. I just find it hard to believe that it's happening in the way people are making out. And when I say this, it has nothing to do with the integrity of an official here. Nothing to do with their work ethic or anything. It's just a job of a portfolio committee 14 years down the road to do its job. It'll be wrong of us. It'll be populist, really. It's not a committee. Not to check for ourselves and convince us that the capacity is there. So in short, our position on assessments, I'm urging the NGO, is we've agreed. Yes to assessment for all, provided the evidence is given to us. And if the evidence matches what was said to us yesterday, that matter is resolved. We won't budge on that. You know, they'll have to call, NGO will have to call a conference to change that view. That's the view of this article. We're not budging on that. So that's settled. But I really feel this thing about diversion worries me a lot, really. About, can I say my own views very quickly, since I'm on the chair, on the table, whatever the word is, just seated here right now, or the mic facing me, or whatever. One, you see, on diversion, I think we're agreeing, and we discussed this in the study group yesterday, that at this stage, tentatively, and it's only an early stage of the discussion, our view is teasing towards the point that we should consider all people for diversion, but we are utterly clear that certain people will not qualify for diversion. Now, if that is the case, do we leave that to the discretion of who? Now, if you leave it to the discretion of the prosecutor, the questions I have to ask as a non-legal person, knowing my country as I've come to, and knowing some of those prosecutors, some of whom are my ex-students, very, very mediocre ex-students, I don't trust them.
to actually make, with the due respect to Sokar and so on, I don't trust them necessarily to make, in complex cases, the decision that's appropriate. And this affects children and their lives. Secondly, I don't know whether we shouldn't have some higher authority to actually oversee, if that's what we're saying, the prosecutor's decision. Prosecutors are human and frail and susceptible to all sorts of pressures. If I come from a certain village in the Eastern Cape, or if I'm a Marxist atheist coming from a middle emerging metro, and the child that is there is a daughter or son of another Marxist atheist Communist Party member who's out there in the wilderness, I may be more sympathetic to, let's say, a diversion there. Who's going to check? Well, I might get paid to do it. And let us be frank, the levels of corruption in this emerging democracy of ours are very high. So I just feel very awkward about the average prosecutor, some of whom are my friends, let me say. I just feel awkward about that. So I would really, Carol, think we, on this diversion thing, we need to have a more nuanced, subtle debate. We need to not just think. And then finally, a question I want to put to JJ. You see, intellectually it's correct to say, separate the issue of policy on diversion from the diversion program. But politically it's not. Because at a particular time in history, you might say, well, ideally diversion should be separated, but given the quality of the diversion programs, that at this stage you have to say not everybody is even entitled to be considered for diversion. Not because you don't agree with it, Steve, as a principle or a value, but because of the quality and nature of the diversion programs. Now, Jackie says to us, well, you know, the norms and say, I read that in your written submissions and so on. But a lot of Christian marks, I don't know. You know, I know norms and standards in local government is a joke, right? Joke. You know, we pass the Municipal Systems Act, what they do. I mean, really, they're meaningless things. I'm not saying it happens here. I only speak for the sphere I know best, local government. And the experience in local government is stunningly clear that though we even put in a law, let's phase in provisions over 20 years to implement the municipal systems model. Hey, man, they're not implementing even 1/20th, 20% of what's there. And they're incapable of doing more. So many, many wonderful pieces of legislation get passed, we can't implement it. So in short, you know this thing about norms and standards having gone up and so on. I would like to know what that means. I would like to know how much better the diversion programs now than then. Finally, the then chairperson told us last night, we met with him on another matter, unconnected to this. He said that the problem at that stage, Steve, you guys had, was, and guys in the gender-neutral sense, is you went and asked NICRO for its diversion program, I think here in Cape Town, and you are stunned to hear that a child that commits rape is required to go, I think if I recall, can members who were there remind me, Bulalani, it was 10 weeks, you go for 1 hour a week for a lecture. And he then made the point that for rape and the consequences of rape, you serve a 10-hour lecture. That's it. Now he pointed out that if somebody went to a court, they could challenge us. That's the point he was making, Lawrence. He said, and it sounded credible to me, but obviously you are lawyers will come back and reply to it. All I can tell you, it impressed me. He said, if you have a victim whose parent then decides, especially with a child that's also been raped, decides to go to court and say, that person raped my child and served 10 hours of lectures and he's out there in the street and my child is battered for life. It's my constitutional right. What did he say? Is there some provision in the
proportionality?
Is something in the... Just explain you know better.
Yeah, no, it's the point that we discussed earlier. It's the whole proportionality thing and that you have a right to have your matter adjudicated in a court of law. Yeah. Can Anne come in?
Yeah.
Are you?
No, please.
Yeah, Dr. Skelton?
Thank you. I think we need to remember that diversion is essentially a conditional withdrawal of charges. Prosecutors always have the power... it's in their discretion to withdraw charges. When they do a diversion, they're saying, we will withdraw the charges on condition that you do these things, whatever those things are, attend a program, et cetera, et cetera. There could be a whole lot of conditions. So in a sense, to speak of being able to prevent prosecutors from diverting is to move into the area of also saying to them that they can't decide when they will prosecute cases and when they will not prosecute cases, which is what they mean when they're talking about dominus litis. They say we are dominus litis. We decide which cases we prosecute and which ones we withdraw. Now, initially, I want to just remind the committee members that were there in 2002. There had originally in the Law Commission been a thought that the preliminary inquiry could allow the magistrate to make the decision about diversion. And that was because some of the concerns that the chairperson, the co-chair, has been mentioning today about, you know, it happens in corridors, let's put it that way. The way diversion happens at the moment is it isn't an extremely formal structure because it's always been happening in the absence of legislation. The idea of the preliminary inquiry was to try and broaden that so that there would be more people present to discuss each case. The prosecutors said they still wanted to be dominus litis and make the final decision, which is why you'll see in the preliminary inquiry chapter, the matter is discussed, but then the prosecutor says, I will or I won't divert this matter. And that was based very much on the fact that at the time, the prosecutors fought very hard for their dominus litis status. Mm-hmm. They said they didn't mind the preliminary inquiry, but they wanted to retain the power to say who would divert. And then, of course, this committee also decided to allow prosecutors to divert without the preliminary inquiry in certain less serious matters, but realizing that in more complex cases, it would be better to have a preliminary inquiry. So I'm really just making the point that the way the bill is structured with the preliminary inquiry doesn't leave everything in the hands of the prosecutor, because the idea of it is it's a kind of roundtable discussion, and if one prosecutor is taking shortcuts and diverting matters because they don't want a full role or whatever, the preliminary inquiry will sort that out. The magistrates will not allow that to keep on occurring. I'm sure that the magistrates will be very concerned about that. So I just want to point out that, you know, a lot of those issues were debated and have been looked at, and it's not as straightforward as that thing of can we trust prosecutors. The role that the legislature, I think, can play is to say that they want to have some regular oversight of the guidelines. And I think that there are examples of legislation like that where the prosecutorial guidelines can be brought back for parliamentary oversight from time to time. I don't think that's inappropriate. I think that would work and may satisfy a lot of your concerns. And it would also mean that this could change over the years. Certain kinds of offences become more prevalent. You know, it would be possible to add to the list of offences where it would be inappropriate. Just the last point on what you were talking about, that program of 10 weeks for rape. That was the Safe Stop program. It was not the NICRO program. And it was actually, that particular program was for children who had not committed rape but other sexual offences. And there had been a repeated misunderstanding about that by the previous chairperson of this committee, which then I think confused everyone else on the committee. But Jackie was involved in Safe Stop. She still has all the materials from that old Safe Stop program, but it's all kind of history now, because since then there are many other service providers in sexual offences. For example, Joan Fenikek, who presented here, I mean, she believes that you should keep children in programs for years and years on end. She actually thinks that if you enter the program when you're 14, you should stay in it till you're 18. And there are programs in Durban that are running like that. So I think that to go back to that debate around that Safe Stop program, which was in the first place a misunderstanding, would be a grave error.
Can I just
please
one release? I promise that we don't have to talk about it, but it's just one related thing.
This role of Parliament, I really like this, to actually look at the prosecutorial guidelines. I really think members must, if this is the direction we are going, then inevitably this is a clause we should consider inserting. But the question I want to ask, Lawrence, prosecutorial guidelines are decided by the NDPP, but finally the minister.
It's in consultation with the minister.
So, you see, if you think Parliament's being too soft, as the executive you can obviously put some pressure on the prosecutor to make those guidelines tougher.
In consultation.
Yeah, well, remember, it's thinking in progress, right? And my mind is very open, right? So I'm just saying, I'm beginning to like this idea that, well, one thing for sure, let me just put where I stand, that I promise I won't interfere. Well, I mean, I'm supposed to interfere, that's my job, but what I mean is I won't interfere unduly. The point I want to make is, you see, I don't think it's sustainable. You know, I saw this in the submissions of CG and so on, that children are being treated worse off than adults. I mean, it's just not acceptable. I thought they were exaggerating. By the way, I must say, Jackie, when I read that stuff, I put question marks. I thought, hey, I'm sure you're spinning, right? I mean, it can't be possible that why are children being targeted more than adults? So I didn't believe you, actually. And I have a right not to believe you. I don't believe anybody else, Bulalani says, which is my job. If I did, then there's no use in me cheering. So I don't believe any of the things I say as well. You know, so I mean, if that makes you feel better. So the point is, well, at least I keep questioning what I think is another way of saying it in a more diplomatic way. But the truth is I don't trust myself. But the point is, you see, one is, I think this committee cannot sustain any view or any principle, unwittingly as it may have been done, that gives gives children fewer rights than adults. That's out. We're not discussing this with anybody. You see, even the two presidents, we're not discussing it with them. Okay? As the president of the ANC and them, these are not issues that we discuss. They must go to the electorate and go and tell them that. Okay? So that's non-negotiable. So that's out. Point two, provided, of course, look carefully, because the NGO is also spinning. We've got to be careful about what they're saying, right? The point two is, I also think that this idea of the prosecutorial guidelines as being the basis on which we pivot issues about diversion may be the route forward, but then we've got to be clear about a framework for those guidelines. And maybe the bill provides a tight framework. Because I think we agree that certain types of offences, murder, rape, a certain type of sexual offence, it's just not on. It's just not on that a 16 or 17-year-old can do it, you know. Not on in our country, not on in Brazil and so on. We have very high levels of crime, and that's another issue we need to look at, whether our levels of crime of children are higher than the ordinary developing society and so on. So I think I've said enough. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Mogonishe?
No, I think the chairperson has covered me, but what I would like to know is about the diversion facilities. Whether do you have enough diversion facilities in rural areas? Because people who have appeared before us are mostly from urban areas. If you divert these children, are there enough quality diversion facilities in rural areas?
Yeah, we haven't heard from social development.
Thanks, Chair. I think I'll start with making reference to the minimum nonsense standards, because the purpose of coming with those standards is to make sure that we standardize services, be it in rural areas and in town. So that's why the department is working on now, to make sure that all programs are accredited in terms of the type of content that we all be comfortable with. We can bring the copy of the minimal norms and standards in the next sitting. You have a copy? Okay.
One other thing on the rural areas. One of the interesting things about the way diversion is structured in the bill is it allows for the court to make orders that will allow children to be diverted to their own homes. So although some will be programs that you have to go and attend a program, there are also these very interesting orders called things like a stay-at-home order or a good behavior order or whatever. So the idea being that if it's a preliminary inquiry, you discover that the problem is this child is not supervised between 2 and 5 in the afternoon, and that's why he's hanging around the shops and shoplifting and what have you, then you actually design your diversion program to fit exactly those needs. You say he will have to stay at school from 2 until 5, the teacher will supervise that, and then he'll be at home by 5:15, and then he has to stay at home in the evening. And you can put all of these things into those orders. So that's just partially an answer to that question about, you know, do we have complete coverage everywhere in the country? If there are instances where there isn't a diversion program available, then these are the kinds of things that you would be able to use instead. So it's not an entirely program-based, although a lot of it will be programmatic. Also to say that there have been quite a lot of pilots of rural diversion. I know the Restorative Justice Center has published their results on rural diversion, and SafeStop also ran rural diversion programs, and they do it a bit differently. So what they say there to the children is, instead of coming once a week to a program over a three-month period or whatever, they do them during the school holidays and make it almost like an intensive process, a camp, where they bring all the children together, because in rural areas it's easier to do it that way. Whether or not there is perfect, absolute 100% coverage, I would doubt, but I think that there has been a massive effort on the part of both government, and this is an area in which non-government service providers play a huge role, and the Department of Social Development partially funds those services through cooperation agreements, I think, service level agreements with those service providers. So perhaps when social development brings that detailed account of how they're going to do assessment everywhere and so on, they could also explain all the diversion programs that they're currently funding through their service level agreements and how they basically see coverage of diversion throughout the country.
Yeah, you see, I think that a final discussion on this area will have to consider the quality, nature, scope, effectivity, content of these diversion programs. So, Shireen, Lawrence, I don't know how we can structure it, but if possible this afternoon when we reconvene, are all the actors here? Can we actually have them present to us diversion programs and so on? Otherwise, what we do is take the debate intellectually so far, but we're not making any political decisions, because until we get a full comprehensive account of those diversion programs, then let's take the discussion as far as we can and then set some conditions, provided A, B, C, we hear from them and we visit some of these diversion programs. And there we don't allow the NGOs to choose. We choose, because the NGOs will send us to the best one. So, we will decide out of a hat, maybe random or whatever. So we go and visit these ones. But, you wanted to say something?
Yes, two things, Chair. I think let me start with the last, but I think it's very important, and that was one of the proposals we were going to make to the committee, to not just visit some of the programs, mm-hmm. but also the two one-stop child justice centers, mm-hmm. because they're very different from each other. And also we've looked at some of those which hinge on, and we've tested the preliminary inquiry, the assessment processes, and and other aspects and facets of the bill in the 2002 bill in those centres. So it's quite important for you to look at them and see them in practice. In addition, because those are in two urban centres, in addition to look at other programs, as you suggested, choose wherever we don't have them, especially in rural areas. And again, it comes back to the point of the training. And I really think, and from a practical implementing point of view, the way the Sexual Offences Amendment has prescribed, which we must annually review, one has to look at those kinds of monitoring mechanisms. And I think one also has to take into account the kind of oversight that this body can play, because there are a lot of those provisions that we have in most of our legislature, and whether the committee can cope with that. Is one thing, but if you look at the way the Sexual Offences Amendment speaks about it, is the DGs must on an annual basis come up with a new policy that is presented. So it's sort of supporting the parliamentary oversight in addition to what the cabinet member responsible must do. That is very important from the training practical implementation. With respect to the last question about whether we could have people here today, I think I would prefer that we suspend it to another day so we could get them and show you the kind of programs that there are, especially with some of the evaluations that we're conducting with these kinds of programs, because it's correct. And restorative justice phenomena and theory suggest service providers external to government are always better placed to provide the services. And so the kinds of accreditation that all the departments are looking at, I think we could bring that in at another time so you get a sense of what programs there are, where they're lacking, and what the challenges are. I think it's better for us to suspend it for now or take it as far as we can today.
These diversion programs, they're run by the NGOs largely. Now, they get money from the state, and to some extent. Now, if, let's say, we decide on what we seem to be deciding, the direction we're taking, there are presumably going to be huge financial implications. And no one's costed for it, and no one's planned for it. And getting irate there.
Full costing of all of this.
Sorry?
There has been a full costing of this bill.
But they're saying there hasn't. Because
in fact, Social Development has even received the funding in their budget over the last 3 years for diversion.
Can I ask something? Okay, I'm going to give you a moment. The question is, when Shireen and them did their costing, they did it on the anticipation that this bill that is currently before us would be implemented. They were hoping that the portfolio committee would just rubber stamp it, presumably, right? So when they were costing, they were not costing for the diversion that we might be opting for. They were costing for the limited diversion in this bill.
Sorry, Chair, can I
just
clarify that? Because I actually was very involved in the initial costing, which was on the 2002 version of the bill. Social Development has done all their planning and implementation on the 2002 version of the bill. Here they are in support. And they have actually, this is going to be one of the few bills in the world where they have actually received budgetary allocations for a bill that has never yet been passed. And they can bring their budgetary statements to show you that.
Except, Chair, that was a while ago. And those budgets have been reprioritized at this point in time. Perhaps not for social development, but for justice. But as a cluster, which is one of the challenges of this, we have not, and we get a cluster budget. We do not have that at the moment. And we would have to go and seek a new budget for this. So I think whilst there were those plans, a lot has changed. We need to update the costing. And the nature of the costing was also different to what we have now. So what I'm saying is correct, but there have been developments in the meanwhile. And there isn't a current costing of the current situation. And it also depends on what you decide hereafter. So those that needs to be taken into account as well.
Yeah, you see, part of the issue surely would be that what we can decide is what is doable. Doable in terms of resources, capacity, the culture of our people, or the mood at the moment, as against maybe 5 years from now and so on, but also about money. So when we get a full report, and maybe we set it for a whole morning, on diversion programs, we should also look at costing, capacity for implementation. Presumably, if we do what we think we might do, then it's going to mean also people must have the capacity to fulfill those wonderful things on paper. See, diversion programs on paper, I'm sure you'll be very impressed, but it's not an academic seminar. We're not judging the quality of your written statement. It's what you're able to do. So, you know, let's leave it at that. That's one of the issues. Finally, a question to you, all of you, raised from Bolalani. Yeah, just a quick Bolalani. Ask this question. Would it be true to say, Lawrence, that crime amongst children is preponderantly in the urban areas, not rural areas, as a matter of interest? What percentage comes... Okay, what percentage come from urban areas, what percentage rural?
Can we present those a bit later to you, but the majority come from the urban areas. It also depends on the nature of the offence. The reporting and the services is how we collect the stats. So sometimes if there aren't services there, we're not collecting the stats as much. So it's quite unwieldy.
We have Soka and then we have Anne.
And then social development after that.
Okay. Now, I just wanted to say that in the original costing that was done, that issue of where the crime happens, there was a survey of that. And the costing suggested that you could cover 80% of the crime if you established 10 one-stop child justice centres. So in sort of key specific areas. I'm not suggesting necessarily that anyone needs to do that. One-stop child justice centres are a kind of optional extra. But it was an illustration based on statistics available at the time that the majority of crime is happening in urban areas. And also that where it does occur in rural areas, there may be better community networks. So, for example, in diversions, you could rely more on neighbourhoods and community structures and so on, and not necessarily always have to have, you know, recourse to a NICRO program or whatever.
Thanks, Chair. I think I just want to place on record that we did the costing, the 2002 bill, and we received funding. We might be different from Justice that maybe after receiving funding, they didn't pursue or try to implement what they were given money for. But with social development, we tried to put in place systems in preparation for the implementation of the bill. Whether it was put on hold or not, we continued, as I indicated yesterday. And I'm aware that this committee maybe doesn't believe when we say we have a capacity, and they've got their own reasons to do so, together maybe with Justice. But what I can say is that since we have moved, because part of the costing was to employ probation officers and also the assistant probation officers, and provide capacity, also funds for NGOs who will be rendering diversion on behalf of the department. And remember, the department is not only managing NGOs for diversion or the whole range, but we do have specific funding for diversion programs. So we will put it in writing when the minister will also support it. But that is the truth that we're telling this body, that we are really prepared with the implementation. Yeah.
No, it's not that we don't believe. It's that we want evidence. That's the simple thing. It's not about a personal integrity of the person speaking. I think I said it yesterday. You're acting in good faith. And the more you speak, the more convinced I become, because you're quite passionate about it. The only point that worries me is, will you be working for the United Nations 6 months down the road? But otherwise, and I'm joking. The fact of the matter is, we want the evidence, and that's what a committee requires itself of itself. It's not about believing. I don't believe Karl Marx for half the things he says. So, you know, it's the same. Anyway, let's go on.
That was a profound statement.
Actually, yeah. Two-thirds of
what. Yeah, I think social development, when you come back to the committee with your readiness document for the implementation, then also bring us the written submission on readiness for implementation, that study that you've done, that, and then also the diversion programs, the information in terms of the service level agreement. Can we step off diversion to the next topic? Is everybody happy? The only thing, Mr. Bassett, that I wanted to just check with you, the comment by the Human Rights Commission in 6.1 on page 5 of the L document. Just to say that I think that that's a valid point.
Yes, that is 6.1, Department agrees that diversion should not be used or seen as a criminal record, but it is crucial to consider the previous diversions when diversion is considered to identify the effect, success or failure of the previous, if any, diversion programs and make an informed decision. I can also point out that the NPA's prosecuting policy provides that offenders, including child offenders with a criminal record and persons to whom the opportunity of diversion has been granted previously, should only be included in diversion, further diversion programs in exceptional circumstances.
Yes,
we agree that that should be seen as a criminal record.
That it should not be seen as a criminal record.
No,
because I think the Human Rights Commission make a valid point. Jackie, you had your hand up, or are you happy? Yeah, Steve?
Just on the diversion, the Human Rights Commission also has a lot to say about the limiting of diversion for certain sexual offences. I think you might have picked that up as well. So it's not highlighted as much in your document, and I think it's also something we need to consider. And some of the implications, they give the example now as it presently formulated, a child of the age of 15 that kisses her boyfriend, remember that crazy scenario, cannot be diverted. Whilst a child of the age of 14 that burns down a house can be diverted. So these are some of the things we've got to look at, the unintended consequences of that. But I do bear in mind, Chair, what you said initially, and we as members of the committee then need to be accountable for our steps that we take and our views that we took, and Johnny was very persuasive, but we agreed with a lot of what he said then, and we also need to understand how we've changed. It's already been quite a sea change with assessing all children, and I think we, once you've had your engagement, we need to consider our views as well on, particularly where I think we are in agreement that all children need to be assessed and preliminary inquiry, but not all children need to be diverted. Now, that is the crux. Once you get to that point, then you go immediately to the schedules, and you start looking at the schedules, and you start to think, now, does one need to limit the prosecutor or not? And that, I think, is where we're going to have the debate.
Yeah.
And then the debate's coming on whether the prosecutor is dominus litis. Can one limit him? How are you going to do it? Prosecutor's guidelines. But I think we're not that far apart. We've come a long way. But I do want to, when you speak to Johnny, you know, to say that members of the committee then are not
we're not rejecting everything we said then. We're trying to remember what the motivations were and all that type of thing.
You are thinking about that. Actually, it's very valuable to have you. Yeah, it's about the kind of thing. Agree with Charlie. That's more interesting. Let me explain. Understand.
This committee needs no permission from any member of the executive to make any amendments. We'll be utterly clear about that. The committees that I've chaired have never, ever asked for permission. What we do, which is nothing to hide about, we have a party political structure called a study group in which ministers serve as ordinary members of the study group, and then they come to these study groups and they argue a case and we listen to them. But if seven of us, all the members who are on the parliamentary side of the study group, decide on a particular course, and two of them who are on the executive side of the study group defer, the seven prevail. The only issue on which they won't prevail, the seven majorities, if we are taking a decision that is against ANC policy. That's how our structure works. There's nothing to hide. It's a democracy. We have our own, Steve, you have your own systems and so on. So, provided the changes we are making do not violate ANC policy, we're going to decide. The reason why we think we should speak to Johnny earlier is because he played the role that he did uniquely of being the chair of the committee at the time and being preponderantly responsible for the changes made. And so I don't think we need to restrict it just to our party politicals. And let me speak to Bulalani and bounce it off it. That we bring along, if Dr. Delport was there, let's meet with Johnny. And say, look, Johnny, you know, these are the things we did in good faith then as a committee. I wasn't there, but I mean, I must take accountability. It's a committee of parliament. But now, 6 years later, this is what we think. So I don't think we should necessarily, we'll have our own party political structures. It would be useful because I really think Johnny would be the best person. Strictly speaking, Johnny should be here, but obviously he's got thousands of responsibilities and it's not fair on him. He's not here and there are people speaking on his behalf who may not have been around even then. So I think we do that. But this is a thought that's going through my head. Because I think there are much more formidable arguments for why the 2002 bill ended up the way it did than is emerging here. And also, Johnny, you see, being now a deputy minister, on issues about capacity of the state and so on, all of us, even if Bulalani became the minister tomorrow, he would have insights that a committee member doesn't have about the capacity of the state, the way departments function, not least your very department. You see, we see slices of you, but he has you all the time. So I really think a meeting, informal meeting, as soon as we come clear about where we are, we include everybody, Dr. Delport, and we have a chat with Donnie one afternoon. And we bring the department officials there and whoever wants to come, and the NGOs, you can come. Let's negotiate it. And let's have it. But first, let the committee members deal with Johnny, and then we have another meeting if need be.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's the way forward? Yeah.
Everybody in agreement on that issue, and I think Steve has summarized it. I don't think there's anything to add from the side of the chair. Are there any other issues on that?
Yeah,
issue?
I just wanted to.
But I would like Steve of you to summarize for me because I'm not absolutely sure on the specific issue of divergence. What have we arrived at? I'm just going to summarize it. But I want to ask whether, if you look at Micro, right, 4.2, it says, Micro further objects to the allocation of a maximum time period.
Micro further objects to the allocation of a maximum time period related to diversion options. Now, they say this because the argument essentially is, and people like Jackie will know more, that children don't respond to the same behavioral initiative. Some will take longer than others and so on. Can somebody reply to that? Or has this issue fallen away now that we've probably taken the direction we are? Loretta?
Thank you, Chair. Now, I would just like to clarify that if you look at the specific sections in the bill, and this is dealt with in Clause 58, it's... the view is out that the reasonable maximum periods have been set, which is 12 and 24 months. If you look at the clauses, how they're worded, it says, let me just go to the clause itself, because it doesn't limit it to those specific periods. Let me just get to 58 for, see, it says, An order exceeding the time period referred to in paragraphs A and B may be given, in which case the reasons for exceeding the time period must be entered on the record of the proceedings. So it's not a case of where you reach 12 months and then it's the end of the line. If there's reasons for you as a specific child to stay longer in this program, there is the option. On both the 12 and 24 months for diversion options under level 1, and then level 2 deals with 4 and 5 years, and is exactly the same clause. So we see it as there's enough leeway here to look at the specific child rather than to say, oh, we're setting minimum periods, and then say NGOC financial worth may be in it to send children for very long periods. So this would make it an individualized case where you have to give reasons if the child needs to stay longer. So we think we're covering it at this stage.
Presumably a child line will suggest that it's like easy way out, you know. Nobody's really going to look at 4C and say, in this particular case. So that's like an intellectual answer. It's not really a practical answer. What they want is the removal of these things. And not that I'm agreeing with them, let me tell you. I just think out of respect for people who come to Parliament, we as Parliament must know why we said no. By the way, before we finish this bill, absolutely every provision, and I've discovered more and more Lawrence that are not here. And you've acted well, but I found at least 5 last night. And I hardly did anything. It was law and order last night. So, you know, from 8:30 to 9:30, my 1 hour... unashamedly. Oh, by the way, those of you wanting to know why I became chair of this committee, I want you to know, I'd rather be upfront, it's very open and transparent. For 11 unstinting years, I have watched Law and Order. I have watched Law and Order from beginning to end. Regrettably, there's 2 more series left. The series 13, they stopped it, right? Now, when I talk of Law and Order, I'm talking of Law and Order proper. But I also... watch Law and Order. What's the other one? Special Victims Unit. I don't like to see that, quite frankly, because it always shows such a bad side to human nature. But Law and Order proper, which is on Tuesday night, yesterday was a riveting performance by a 79-year-old man about identity. Who saw Law and Order yesterday? Who's that? Hey, wasn't it wonderful about this man seeking his dignity? You know, but I want to tell you, in provincial and local government, I instructed the ANC study group, Bulalani, I instructed the ANC study group to watch Law and Order, Maggie. And if members did not watch Law and Order, they were not allowed to speak. So if somebody put their hand up and said, Comrade Charlotte, did you watch Law and Order last night? And she says, no, put your hand down. You, Comrade Bangi, did you watch Law and Order? No, you couldn't speak. Now the opposition members, Gloria Bowman puts her hand up, you see. And then I can't instruct the opposition members or to watch Law and Order. So she put her hand up and she asked a question. My reply to her, you see, Gloria, I can just see you didn't watch Law and Order last night. So she says, how? I said, look at the quality of the question you're asking. Very poor. If you watch Law and Order regularly. So for those of you who are mystified about why I'm here, it's a simple answer. Somebody in Lutuli House found out. When they had to move Fatima, for the reasons they had to move her, unfortunately for her, they looked around and they said, now in this list here, Bulalana Magwanishi, he's a lawyer, he's politically very sophisticated, he's young, he's dynamic, he dresses well. No, but he doesn't watch law. I don't think he knows Law and Order. Imam, yeah, he's very senior and so on, but we've got something else in mind for him. Then they looked at this thing and they discovered nobody in this committee watches Law and Order. And then somebody told them, hey, the guy that watches Law and Order, that's Yunus. He's the best qualified to be the chair. So that's the sophisticated Marxist-Leninist method, Steve, that the ANC uses to choose chairpersons. So now I've answered your question, so to be a mystifier. But on this issue now of NICRO, can I just raise something very quickly? I don't agree with NICRO, actually. But I just want to know why I don't agree with them, right? And I'm not convinced, Lorette, with due respect to you about 4C. So unless somebody else wants to pick up NICRO, I think we should not agree with them. I also think between you, me, Christine, and JJ, we must tick off those things that we're saying yes to and no, so that when we do the phase 2 of the bill, we're not going to go slowly through. We're just going to have ticks where we agree. Now, on the issue of Human Rights Commission, I think we've agreed with it. Is that correct? So I hope somebody's ticked it off. Right? So we're not coming back to that. On the issue of NICRO, are we saying no? Is there somebody here who agrees with NICRO? Or maybe there's a case for NICRO. Do you want to speak on their behalf, Jackie? Even if you don't agree with them, what's their argument beyond what's there?
I think their concern is, and it has happened on occasion, that you will find during the course, obviously you have your assessment process and you say that this child needs a particular program and the order gets made and the child goes off to the program. And during the course of the program, often you will find that further risk factors in relation to that particular child becomes known, which children don't necessarily disclose at the initial stages of entering into the criminal justice system. They build a relationship with the diversion service provider, and the point is that sometimes there's a feeling that that child needs further intervention. Once the court order expires, there's nothing you can do. The child must just go. So I think that's the concern. So, yeah, I mean, I can understand what they're trying to say, but I also think that it's covered. Or maybe there could be a provision saying that then the diversion service provider could come back to court to revisit, but that's also very, very difficult because that's very arbitrary. You should actually have certainty right up front. Sorry, can I also just say that in certain, I mean, this is the other thing, is that in certain instances, if we're looking at the main matters that are going to be diverted, they're not going to be those complex matters involving extremely serious offences or sexual offences. And the time periods given are quite long. They're much longer than what's happening at present. So you are looking at potentially a maximum of 5 years. And even though Childline does recommend lengthy ongoing, you know, the point is that I think that it's quite covered within that maximum 5 year period for the complex cases. Your middle of the range ones, which are the majority of diversions, don't take that long. So I don't think this is just for the exceptional case, I think.
Mr. Bassett, you had your...
Sorry, I think Jackie's really covered what I was going to say, but it might be useful to hear from the Department of Social Development as well, the experts.
Okay, let's hear from Social Development and then Mr. Swart.
Okay, what I wanted to say is that the minimum norms and standards also provide for aftercare, so that NICRO, if they have the child who's going through a diversion, if the court order is left, and then they can continue. It doesn't restrict them to say now the case is over. It makes provision for them to provide aftercare services later on.
Steve?
Just principally now, have we finished the diversion yet?
No.
Because I think what Jackie said now, certain cases will not be diverted. Maybe we need, or did you say something along those, or certain more serious cases? Just to, because I think, I do appreciate where you're coming from, that you'd like all cases to be diverted. But obviously we're sitting with a situation where we've got schedules that have put in place various matters that will not be diverted. And I think that we're going to find, that we're going to look at those schedules and see maybe we've been too harsh on that listing and come to a point where we water those schedules down. I think that's when we engage with Johnny, that's because he'll defend the schedules at the moment and the exclusion of 57. And I think that is the key point, is where we start looking at which are, because our view is all children should be assessed. Those that are not, the prosecutor does not divert and go to the PI, they should all be considered for diversion, but in that there's a caveat that certain will not be diverted. And I think that last bit is where we're going to look then at the schedules and to what degree we can limit the prosecutor's authority. But we do need input from the prosecutors, because they gave their submission on the basis of the present bill with the schedules as they are at present. So we would need to hear something in writing once we have formulated our suggestion as to what the prosecutor's view is. Chair, I'm just engaging on the concept of that certain matters will not be diverted. If we say all children will be assessed, all children will go through the PI, but some will not be diverted, then that gets to the crux of the matter, is the schedule set out at the moment, which may not and which can be diverted. When we speak to Johnny, he'll defend them all, and he'll say, but Steve, you were there, you agreed, but a change has happened. So that's where the discussions take place, as to which specific offences should be included, which should be limited. Can we limit the prosecutor's discretion in terms of separation of powers? The prosecutors gave their submission on the existing bill. We would need to hear from them
whether they are happy that we, in a sense, should we so decide, start diluting and looking at the schedule, considering particularly Section 57, which the Human Rights Commission has said is unconstitutional in its formulation. So that's, I think, where we are getting to a much closer point, where we will be looking at that. But I think that last, where we say all will be considered for diversion, but some will not be diverted, there's a bit of a contradiction in that. We're going to have to really carefully look at that.
Yeah, I think we're pretty much all on the same page. If I read everybody correctly, that we're all saying all children should be considered, but it may not be appropriate, and then you go to your schedules. Jackie can speak to it.
Sorry, yeah, we'd be, from an NGO perspective, we'd be very happy to at least allow for the eligibility of consideration. Obviously, we know, I mean, I'm a pragmatist. I know that most children that commit very heinous offences are not going to be diverted. But you might have a child who's charged with a murder or with a rape situation where the circumstances of that matter allow, the exceptional circumstances allow the prosecutor to exercise their discretion. So then, I mean, we'd be very happy with some kind of formulation where there's no legislative exclusion from consideration of diversion, but there are strict guidelines in place to control the exercise of that consideration. I mean, that's just, we're really happy with that.
So just getting back to the NICRO issue, is everybody happy with that now, that we don't agree with NICRO, and we're happy with Dr. Lowe's explanation? Happy? Okay.
What about, because I'm not clear personally, what now have we decided on diversion?
Yeah. I think, yeah, and please stop me if I'm wrong, I think we've decided that any distinguishing procedure between adults and children, that's out.
Okay, no discrimination.
No discrimination, no arbitrary procedure. Secondly, I think we've pretty much agreed that, subject to the discussion that we will have with Johnny, pending practical considerations, implementation, and things that were discussed by the committee in 2002, that we're of the view that at least all children, regardless of age and offence, should be considered to be eligible for diversion. But that not all children will be diverted based on the schedules and the offences, as the case may be. I think that that's where we are. In broad.
No, can I?
We need input from the NPA, because they formulated their submission on the present formulation of the bill. This is a new concept now. We are moving like the way we're broadening it more. They would probably support it because it would enhance their dominant leaders that they carry, and it would support the Human Rights Commission's argument that by limiting in legislation, the prosecutor's authority, we are infringing the separation of powers. This example is Section 57 on the sexual offences. But the problem that we've got is, if we say that they're all eligible, and then we say that we're limiting it, is it not a problem? How do you say you're eligible to it, but then in your schedule you say you're not entitled to it?
Excuse me, Chair, the answer is in may and must. All must be, but you may not divert in certain cases. You must consider all matters, but you may refuse to divert, or may not refuse, not divert in the schedule, the list of effects.
Yeah, Jackie, go for it.
Sorry, I just thought that, you know, maybe, well, my understanding would be is that the legislation does not exclude any child from the possibility of diversion. And then in Clause 95, I thought was probably the best place, directing the National Prosecuting Authority to develop guidelines based on certain schedules as to when diversion should not be considered. should not, and use that kind of discretionary terminology. And then that would allow for exceptional. I don't think one can say you can be considered, but you can't be diverted. You can be considered, but the guidelines say that in these cases one should not consider unless exceptional circumstances. You can't do the. You can be considered. Yeah.
Except that the poor drafters have got to change it every time we change our minds.
I'm not following, maybe again because I'm not a lawyer. But can I just simplify things? Right? So I know what's happening. It's important that that one does, because ultimately we have to take this to the study group and explain to people, right? So firstly, I think we agree there can be no discrimination between adults and children,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did you mean by no arbitrary procedure?
No, just to say that if you have two pieces of two practices where adults are afforded X rights and children are afforded Y rights, and there's no logical reason, and then that would be arbitrary action on the part of the legislature.
Political point, we don't need that explanation. Right. Then it says, subject to JDL, that's Johnny DeLanga, all children should be considered for diversion, but there is no guarantee that all children will in fact be diverted, something like that.
Yeah.
I'll find the appropriate wording. But I don't think it should be subject to JDL. I think there's a second point here. There's a first point which is all children should be considered for diversion, but not all of them should necessarily get it. That's point two. Then point two, provided, comma, that the capacity, the cost, the implementability of this is provided in evidence to the committee. That must first happen. Then we go to Johnny and say, look, Johnny, this is what we've come up with. What is it that we had in 2002 that you feel still obtains? We've got the argument, we've got the evidence now. We show him the evidence as well in a subcommittee meeting and see what he says. I don't think point two should be subject to Johnny.
It's
provided we have the necessary evidence. Wouldn't that be the point? I'm not sure. You can disagree with me.
No,
I don't know.
Fine.
I'm just asking. Isn't that the way?
Right. Yeah,
that, so we say provided. And let's make the starting provided that the relevant evidence, and I'll put it down on paper and show it to Carol, or Carol will put it down on paper, and Chris, whoever will do it, right, fine, you get the point, right? Then three, the step three is, no. This thing I don't understand, and Steve's leaving, but maybe others of you will help me. What does this mean now? We need an input from the NPA. So even Johnny shouldn't come in here. Let's get the point. Step three will be input from the NPA. It is broadening their role. It also deals with the HRCs. I haven't read the HRC submission yet, which says that something's unconstitutional because it limits the role of the prosecutor. What does this point four now mean? What is it? Explain to me, please.
I just suggested that we need the NPA or Dominus Litis.
Right.
And a lot of the arguments in CBGJB19, which is the Human Rights Commission, are related to this legislation infringing on the separation of powers by limiting the discretion of the NPA. Now, the NPA might come out and agree with that in their submission on our proposed amendments and saying if we go more lenient and allow greater diversion, that gives us a greater discretion that deals with the constitutionality argument raised by the Human Rights Commission.
How will we be given the greater
power? The discretion, there will be more children will be given access to diversion, which gives them a greater discretion. Mm-hmm. Whereas at the moment the legislation is quite narrow, the schedule is limited, and therefore they could argue that it's limiting, as the Human Rights Commission argued, particularly Section 57.
Oh, I see your point. Mm-hmm. Because the schedule is limited.
The schedule is limited, and Section 57 particularly limits in sexual offences.
And maybe just to add the whole thing, the argument about the dominus legis is because of section 197(2) of the Constitution.
Okay, I'll have a look at that. Yeah,
which says that the prosecuting authority has the power to institute criminal proceedings and any functions
okay,
incidental
thereto. Right.
Now,
so one final
thing. Now, you see, yeah, we are saying
that the NPA must develop guidelines, okay? And now, surely we can't leave them totally free to develop guidelines. If we decide that certain offences are out for diversion, no. But now we are saying all offences must be considered for diversion,
yeah.
Right?
That's the debate.
Yeah, but can I ask you a question then? In theory, it's possible then that somebody who commits rape, wanton rape, or let's say murder. With aggravated circumstances. What's the word? Robbery. Okay, let's say murder. 17-year-old chap commits murder. Are we still going to consider him for diversion?
No.
And that's my dilemma that I'm struggling with, whether one has an overall allowance, as Jackie has suggested, or whether you have some form of schedules which limits, as is.
I really feel, look at my own view, right? If they defeat me, it's fine. I really feel no, man. That's not on. You can't say
the point is you're a great negotiator. There are three schedules now. They might just start looking at the schedules and saying, which do we want to insert at the moment, which makes it absolute cut and dry that there will be no diversion and it's in the schedules now. We set that out. As opposed to now where there's three schedules that limit it tremendously. You might be able to open it to a certain degree or open it fully. But I tend to didn't agree with you that we've got to be very careful how we go about that.
Yes. I don't know what I'm saying. Well, we have a meeting. I know what I'm saying, what I feel.
I don't know what the meaning of what I'm saying is for the current discussion.
Meaning is,
and you can't expect me to find the answer.
The
I'm putting
schedules.
Yeah.
Yes. You're referring
to
the schedules and the offences set out in the schedules, which limit or allow for diversion.
Yeah.
And that's where we need to look. And to identify the offences there, which we say these are totally now, Jackie, you might persuade us otherwise. I know you're looking at me with big eyes, but that's the debate that we've got to. We're moving from a situation where we had very limited diversion. We had one schedule one, and we had in certain circumstances other parts, the section 57. We might want to start looking at the other schedules and say, why is there not diversion allowed in those cases? Or we might want to take Jackie's viewpoint where she says, do away with the schedules, I think. Is it? And something, you know, so it's somewhere along there.
Yeah,
but the crux lies with the schedules. And Section 57 sets out a limitation only for sexual offences. But it might be useful to look at those guidelines that are set out there as well.
Okay, I'll come back with a clear thought.
Yeah. So what you're saying, as if I understand now, is that not all children will be considered to be eligible.
Well, you see, I've got a bit of, and I need assistance. If we say all children are eligible for diversion, then you can't have a schedule. Unless you take Dr. Delport's viewpoint, the must and the may, that might be a way of getting around it. But at the moment, it says in these cases, in these two schedules, schedule 2 and 3, no diversion takes place. So if we say all children are eligible for diversion, then we're going to have to formulate it in a way that ties up with the schedules, allowing the discretion. It's quite complex. Lawrence, what do you...
I'm also a bit confused now. I'm getting a sense that there are two options that we're looking at where everybody is qualifies for consideration of diversion, and then the other option is to perhaps limit the offences that do not qualify for diversion at all, like premeditated murder. Is that what we're talking about?
Easier in our discussions with Johnny, because Johnny's going to defend his position here.
Yeah.
We make the law, but clearly it's a sea change from the executive's position at the moment. And if you were to start finding a middle, in between way, Jackie.
So I'm going to ask Jackie and then JJ can come in.
Yeah,
than Eunice.
I agree with Lawrence because I think there are two options now. The one is, and this is the one obviously that we would prefer, is that all children are eligible for diversion. There are no exclusions in the legislation, and that the NPA develops guidelines to say when in exceptional circumstances, in certain offences, children may be diverted. The other option is that certain children are excluded from the possibility of diversion based on the schedules, and then we write back to where we were with the effect that all adults at present in terms of the fact that there's no legislation on diversion are still eligible in terms of the NPA guidelines based on the wording of those guidelines. So those, as I see it, are the two options, because you can't have all children being eligible for consideration and then just basically in the next section taking that eligibility away by referring to schedules which don't allow for the diversion. And just on the point of, and I do, I mean, it's fully, obviously, it's within your decision to go for one option or the other, but, and I realize that there are problems when it comes to certain offenses, and that's why you might want to limit it. Premeditated murder on being a case in point. But what I'm also trying to say is that there are those very, very strange exceptions. So, for example, you might have the situation of a 15-year-old girl who notes that her mother's, and I'm talking off the top of my head, notes that her mother's boyfriend is sexually abusing her 6-year-old sister and then plans his murder. Now, in those circumstances, it's very, very, it's going to be very difficult for her to be diverted, but that's certainly a different situation to a 15-year-old child who premeditates a murder against, you know, a schoolmate at school because he was slighted. So I really believe that there needs to be a way that those exceptional cases could still be considered. And the moment that you say premeditated murder is not eligible, that's never going to happen. And murder's the difficult one. Rape is always also very emotive, but the point is that, and if you look, and I would refer you to the RAPCAN submission, it's very good on that point, is that it says that if you want to prevent children who offend with sexual offences from reoffending, you intervene. And our experience with Say Stop, and I really don't want to raise Say Stop because it caused a lot of problems last time, but the point is that you have families where there are children involved, where the victim is a child, and the families come and say to you, I don't want the neighbor's child who did this to my daughter going into the criminal justice system, but I also want them to have sort of some intervention. And the families want those kids to be diverted. They live in a community, they don't want that child to have the stigma of going through the criminal justice system. So it's not just the child offender activist saying this, it's also the victims, families who want, particularly with sexual offences, the possibility of, in certain cases, that this child can be diverted. Obviously, you might then categorise rape, and you could say rape where there is aggravating, grievous bodily harm. Then no, but rape as a single entity is very difficult, I would submit, to stop.
I'm playing a role as both a co-chair and facilitator. Can I ask you a question? You see, my position, JT, you're going to help me outside this meeting. On the one hand, I feel all children should be considered for diversion, even if not all get it. But on the other hand, I think there are some cases where it's very clear. They should not be diverted, right? I mean, there are people, I know it in my neighborhood, sad, who do the most heinous things, who are under 18. And there's no way they could justify diversion. So can't we have the reverse of what you're saying, where we say, well, two things you should realize. One is you're saying, you see that example you gave of this 15-year-old girl, her 6-year-old daughter, her sister is being abused by her stepfather, whoever. Morally, if that's true, personally, I don't think a person like that should pay any consequences, really. She needs help. She shouldn't have killed a guy. But morally, what's wrong with that? That's my view. I don't care who's listening. Right, they can speak to me outside this meeting. The point is, that shouldn't we do it the other way around, which is to say that these four or five things, premeditated murder, let's say, I don't know what the legal terms use, terrible rape, horrible rape, a 17-year-old boy rapes 5-6-year-old girl. Those cases, there's no diversion unless there are exceptional circumstances. So in other words, it's turn it around and say, in the case of 1, 2, 3, 4, I only think about four things. That's the schedule. We put a schedule there, Steve, that says these 1, 2, 3, 4 things, no diversion, unless we got a case like you referred to. So it's turning it around, point one. Point two is, when we are, JJ, please help us, so you keep your hand up, but you don't have to, both of us have seen it, it's such a big hand. Now the point is, it's slightly intimidating actually to have somebody say, we've seen you, mate. The fact is, JJ, you see, they are suggesting in your absence, and there's been a lot of progress, let me tell you, in your absence. Maybe it's related to the fact that you were not here, but the fact is, can I just raise this? You see, if you want to go the guidelines route, Steve, must you leave it completely free to the NDPP or NPA? Or can't we in law, but we know the minister also has a role, right? But can't we in law say the NDPP determines the guidelines, but in shaping its guidelines, it takes account of like 1, 2, 3, 4, veering them in the direction of saying certain types of crime, even if it's by children, it's out. Except if there's exceptional circumstances, Jackie is saying. That may be another route. Okay.
JJ, and then who had their hand up? Lorette, and then I saw Lawrence. No, I saw Shireen. And then who else?
Lorette.
Lorette, and then Shireen. Okay.
Okay. I mean, look, as I explained, I had to be out. It took a bit longer. But I'm a bit surprised. You seem to be where you were when I left, so I'm not sure what all the progress is. But I think so. I might have missed things, but also it might be being able to bring people back. I don't know if it's those two ways of you and I think Chair, you started. I mean, Co-Chair, you started to go onto it. I think to have absolute restrictions is not going to be consistent with the existing law. If you're going to then start saying certain categories of offences cannot be considered for diversion, we're going to have to legislate that for everybody. You can't just have a regime where that only applies to children. So I for me personally, we've still got to discuss it within our caucus and things like that. But personally, that would be at this stage that would be problematic for me. The existing setup seems to be working fine, which is for everybody, children, adults, whatever, that people can be considered, but in particular cases, in terms of the NPA guidelines, they can only be considered under exceptional circumstances. So that seems to be fine. I don't know then why we want to change that. If we do, because we say, well, we don't trust, I think the NPA guidelines have to be approved by cabinet, don't they?
Yeah.
Yes. If we can say, look, we don't trust the executive, we want to put it in legislation, then let's, as the co-chair had suggested, let's rather look at then, so the first option would be leave it just simply in terms of prosecutorial guidelines, as it is at the moment. The other option of saying certain categories excluded entirely, I think it's going to be very difficult to sustain that if you only do it for children. Then we should be passing a diversion law which applies to everybody. So for me, the other option would be to maybe legislate, Chair, what you were suggesting, that we provide some kind of legislative form to the prosecutorial guidelines. We can say the prosecutorial guidelines will determine it, but as you say, these categories should only be considered under exceptional circumstances. So that would be then trying to legislate in more of a framework to what is there already. But I think to be quite clear, to my mind, we're talking about the possibility of diversion. We're not saying that any offence automatically qualifies, no matter how minor, automatically qualifies for diversion. So we can't even say that children who are arrested for
shoplifting must be diverted. There's no must, even on that side of the scale. I would have thought that they should be diverted unless there's exceptional circumstances why they shouldn't be. Whereas on the other end of the scale, I don't think that murderers should be diverted unless there are exceptional circumstances. So it goes that way. But so really, I think in short, the way I would want to put it, table it if it hasn't been sort of done really, is that we look at two options. One is that we keep the situation as it currently exists in law, whereby anybody can be considered for diversion, and it is up to the prosecutorial guidelines to determine whether they are diverted or not. That option two becomes that we legislate in a framework for those guidelines. And obviously option three is that we then say there are certain categories that are entirely excluded, but the difficulty with that is I don't think we've got to then do it for everybody. I think it's inconsistent to restrict it to children.
So if I can paraphrase, what you're saying is that not all children will automatically be diverted, will automatically be considered, but by the same token there's not an absolute bar for certain children based on certain offences to be excluded. That it is all based on the prosecutorial guidelines and the discretion.
Yes, but the option two I'm saying is all children can be considered. However, on a sliding scale, and the implementation will be in terms of the prosecutorial guidelines, but certain categories can only be considered under exceptional circumstances. Which is, as I said, it's I think legislating the existing situation, but just more, I suppose, putting legislative flesh to the guidelines. The guidelines sound fine at the moment. The implementation sounds fine. I haven't heard of any cases, there may well be, where they've been wrongly applied. But just in case we think that Maggie's going to write in that murderers must be strongly considered for diversion, then we'll legislate,
Just remember that, like, for example, what we did on the prosecutorial guidelines for the TRC crimes, we said that it has to come to this committee for approval. So, I mean, there were various sort of checks and balances and safeguards that one could put in. Lorette and then Shireen. Lorette, you're fine. Yeah, Shireen?
Sorry, most of mine have been covered, but I think it's very important, especially when I look at what we're doing with implementing the Sexual Offences Amendment, is that not every scenario can be legislated for. I think that's very, very important to consider. But over and above that, I think what we're finding from an implementation point, particularly on child justice, is the social phenomena have changed so much and how it impacts on the criminal justice system. And whereas there aren't other options for intervention at the moment, the criminal justice system becomes the option. And to look at remedying some of those social ills, considering that this is a diversion process, one has to be very mindful of how much social issues you can address through criminal justice law. And we just find that challenge quite a major challenge, because it's the social aspect and the social cluster, as an example, needs to deal with it, but we can't also intervene in redressing all of those ills in this one. It's a very hard decision, but one has to look at it from that perspective. And then the last one is the bill presumes highly trained people. And that's where, again, the mechanisms, the monitoring mechanisms, have got to be very tight. And I think so far the best one is the review of the sexual offences and the directions that are provided there, because it gives you the categories that you need to consider for training. So we need to be mindful of that from a intellectual capacity point of view.
Thanks, Chair. You might have covered it in your last little remark, but at one stage of this debate as well, it was suggested that there should be some sort of linkage to parliamentary oversight. I know the NPA comes but on a yearly basis, but that can also be part of the process where Parliament plays a role in that regard, and we can legislate that specifically.
Because I can definitely remember us debating the TRC guidelines a few times.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Delport there at
No, he wasn't. Mrs. Cameron was there, your favorite.
They caused problems when they take it to other floor. Anyway,
I'll take it up with you also at this meeting. I'm very surprised about that. All right. Just a few quick things. One is, have we covered this one? Now, the legal aid board 5-1 on page 5 of L. The LAB is concerned that the child has acknowledged responsibility for the offence. Blah, blah, blah. This may contravene the presumption of offence. What have we decided about this?
I raised that with him yesterday. That is their role. If they are the legal advisor to the child, then they are to ascertain whether the child should acknowledge blame or not. But, you know, maybe that's something that we didn't quite understand. If they are involved in the process, surely they are there. My concern was that they might, in fact, try to get them to evade responsibility. The counter might well happen. The whole concept of restorative justice. Yeah, the whole concept is that they accept blame.
Right. Okay, so we say no. I just want them not to come back to see Lawrence. We see there's some marginal progress. You want to get to 3 and 3.
The Human Rights Commission says that's covered that. Yeah. We've agreed to that. Okay, we've said yes. Okay.
Anything else on diversion? Going. Gone.
For today.
We're going to break at 1 for lunch. And then, so we'll meet in the conference. We're breaking at 1. Let's say 3:10. Because most of the time, the chairperson and the convener is not always early.
Yeah, but this is an old committee. Because we are sitting. I thought until
6, but I see the House rises at 5:15. Can we raise this with Lolly? These are legitimate committee meetings. There are people who have transport problems. Once the House rises at 5:15, I think the transport leaves at 5:30. Yeah, so we'll have to end by 5:25. But that can't hold us up, a transport issue. When the committee is meeting in legitimate meetings, and the House rises much earlier than 5, the committee must arrange for transport for 4 people to go to Laboria and
Pelican.
Acacia Park people I can give a lift to. Can we discuss that? Yeah. We've done it in provincial and local government, so paid for by the committee. No, it can't happen for today. So today what we're going to do is, let's meet at 2:30 or 2:15 or whatever, and get started. Oh, you won't be here. Yeah. JJ, can you be here about 2:15?
I'm going to send you.
Let's make it 2:30 because all 3 chairs are not available. Okay, and we're not sunbathing on the beaches. We have an ANC meeting. So 2:30 till 5:30. And the people who have to leave will roll out at about 5:20 for their buses. But in future, we're going to sit till 6. Okay. And I suspect in the second quarter, it'll have to be later as well. But you will arrange supper and so on. Or we break into subcommittees and process bills, but we really have this traditional courts bill before us, and we would like to finish it by the end of June, if possible. But we need further discussion around that, Bulalani, because it's your bill. But we'll talk about it outside.
The only thing is, there isn't going to be any committee members except for the chair. Steve's going into the house. Eunice, you and JJ are at the cluster meeting. Dr. Galbord is in the house. Mm. So it's only I'm going to be the whole committee. Which is fantastic now from
Boston. No, you know, we will have to go ahead. I mean, in your case, one of you can be here, Len can be here. We're going to have this problem all the time. What we did in previous committees is we called them subcommittees, and then we reported back to the rest of the committee. So whether it's a subcommittee form or a committee, I think we must go ahead, really. In the case of ACDP, we understand, but DA can forego one person to be here.
Yeah, I mean, it's social
governance.
I didn't know that Dr.
Belfort
was involved.
Would you not?
And I mean, obviously, the ACDP is small, so they've got a double up. But
no, but Len's going to be here.
Also, the issue would be, can we not, if we sit when the House is sitting, can we not sit in, like, D26 or D249, the members that do have business, I mean, if the slide says you've got a question, you have to be there.
Yeah, only for the question.
Then they can easily pop up.
All right, can we just check for now? We've got half an hour. Can you check if G26 is free?
Out of bounds.
What do you mean out of bounds?
D249.
Why can't it be used?
It's only for the speaker as of beginning of this day.
Yeah, I think that the issue should be, I mean, it's been agreed those committees with lots of legislation will be prioritized, so maybe check if you can take it up with the House Chair Committee. But, I mean, we're only asking for those venues
on certain days.
On the afternoon.
Yeah, okay, but look, we are meeting today. Even if I'm here with Carol alone, we are meeting.
Why don't we do a...
Is H in criminal capacity? So if you can maybe just leave the H in offense differentiation and come back to that, although I think to a large degree that falls away.
That's been taken care of.
So we can leave that then. Okay, let's go on to H in criminal capacity.
Thank you, Chair. One of the comments is that the bill originally provided for a minimum of 10 years, and that was at the instance, at the recommendation of the South African Law Reform Commission. This is Professor Slap Nielsen's submission. She pointed out to the committee that there have been developments since then when the bill set the age at 10 years old, and pointing out that the Committee on the Rights of the Child recommends that the age be increased to 12 years and that we possibly do away with the irrebuttable presumption that's still in the bill. She also makes the point that reference should be made to minimum age of criminal responsibility, and we shouldn't be using the term criminal capacity, because criminal responsibility is more acceptable in terms of international law.
I want to know why. I'm saying that to me, I couldn't work out. That's the professor's
perspective. I think we've, in South African law, and my colleagues can help me if I'm wrong, it's always been criminal capacity, and that's what the previous bill did, and that the Law Commission is talking about.
Sorry, I was just going to add, it's also very punitive in your language. With this bill, it's rather restorative, and the trends have been now to use language that's more acceptable. Because when you're presuming criminal capacity, it's just giving you that edge that you've got capacity to be a criminal, as opposed to accepting responsibility, which is the more acceptable term under restorative justice norms and standards. And that's really where the world is moving to. It also comes from our...
Responsibility is the more common now.
Yes.
Because you could have capacity, but really... the main issue is, are you responsible for what you actually did? And they're slightly different issues. So why don't we use the term criminal responsibility, if that's the norm?
Because a lot of what we put in the bill comes from the Roman Dutch law and the common law that was there at the time. So this is now a shift from where we are.
So the department, I don't think we have strong views, but...
Now my worry with the change is that, I mean... We do criminal law, there's a category called criminal capacity, which has a particular meaning, and whether you've got the capacity to commit a crime, mentally, intellectually. Now, if we're going to start, different people have different legal systems. That's ours. May be right or it may be wrong, but I mean there might be convergence as far as law, but my worry would be to tamper with a fundamental concept at this stage. I think we need to tread carefully. We can look at it, but let's tread carefully is all I'm saying. I don't think it's just simply changing a word.
I think one has to be also mindful as to where law came from in this country and how it had evolved. The principles of restorative justice for many years have been put out as though they are not
something that is African or very perhaps coming from other parts of the world, which is something that we've inbuilt and had in our country for many years. It's not been codified in the same way that other legal systems are. So one has to also look at the development of law, and restorative justice isn't in our law book. And that change needs to happen, whether it was there before or not. We've changed radically on many positions, both in our constitution and in our criminal and our case law, as we mentioned earlier, changing the phenomena. And most of the cases on restorative justice are using these terms, irrespective of how it was before. So one has to look at that as a legal principle. Just because it was that way does not mean that it must continue. Law is dynamic and ever-evolving. And that's what the paradigm of restorative justice really puts across, because it's a whole new system. And that is why it's so shifty and so weighty, because it's never been codified, and we're still, you know, looking at the concepts and how they must be then implemented.
I like what you're saying, but more generally given that. In other words, the subject is not over-sector, what you're saying is criminal responsibility is more appropriate, given that we are now adopting an implicit justice.
Look, I think, I mean, I've got a law professor next to me. I mean, I learnt about capacity, criminal capacity. That has meaning. I'm not sure about criminal responsibility, and if you start in exchanging them, will that have the same meaning? But maybe, even though he's from a different party, maybe the law professor can give his comments. All I was though saying in short was that, look, we can look at changing it, but it's not something we should do lightly.
The old word in what we then adopted in Afrikaans is toerekeningsvatbaar. In other words, it means whatever you do does cannot even be a criminal act. If you say change that to criminal responsibility, it means you're a criminal, but we're not going to hold you responsible. So the more protective word is in fact criminal capacity, because we say at below a certain age you cannot, you don't have the power, so the competence to commit a criminal act. So criminal capacity is actually the more accurate word, but if it evolves in our law that we are talking about criminal responsibility and we mean the same thing, I'm the last one to say that we're not subject to change.
Imam and then Shireen.
Chairperson, the way I understand it in my own mind is that there are two things here, two elements. It's an age and also then a capacity or a responsibility. At the age, I think, is the more, you know, important element here, age, right? If that changes, right, then it's okay, no problem, then it changes. Whether we use this capacity or responsibility, I don't think matters very much, but we've changed the age, and I think that's important. Right? So we can use responsibility, I think, no problem. The age will change, the number.
Chair, yeah, quick point. This bill shows a tension between two different legal systems. When you had earlier, when you looked at preliminary inquiry, acknowledging responsibility is not a concept in the adversarial system. And this bill is the tension between the adversarial system and the restorative justice system. So at some point you're going to have to look at, because if you take that position on responsibility, you're going to go back and have to refer to all of it. Because you constantly, almost to apologists, whatever is a legal equivalent, I can't remember that term, but you've got to look at it from that perspective, because if that happens all across the world, you're pulling two different concepts from two different paradigms, and at some point it is going to be a tension, and we've got to look at it from practicalities on the side, what is, how you deal with it. And I use the example of the criminal inquiry. Acknowledging responsibility conflicts directly with the presumption of an innocence, presumption of innocence. And again, here you're having the same tension. And you see that throughout the thread of the bill as to where, how we decide. And that is why it's done in the different streams. And I think when we do the further clause by clause, you'll see how the different streams work so that you can understand how you interlink between the adversarial system and the current restorative justice system. Because at some point, you're also going to conflict with Section 35 of the Constitution. And that's one of the problems with the restorative justice system. Can members live with responsibility?
I still want more work on it. I don't. Also, the common law is capacity.
But we're amending the common law further on in the bill. But be that as it may.
We're saying the common law pertaining to criminal capacity of children below 10 years is hereby amended. That was over the age issue. But I think we would have to fundamentally say, well, we are amending the common law now to refer to responsibility. So I think, can we leave it open and come back to it?
Okay, let's flag that for the moment. And the crux of the matter, really, the 10 years or not. Can I hear members on that? My personal view is, members will recall the Human Rights Commission brought us a list of the ages across the world, and particularly in developing countries. My personal sense is that it should be 12 years old, but let me hear from members. JJ?
I mean, maybe to the department. Why did we... I mean, it's currently 7. The argument that we hear is on the basis, one, it's international norms. It's a minimum of 12, although it goes higher. That includes in developing countries. I think Uganda was cited. I can't remember where else.
Mozambique, Uganda,
why was the proposal 10? What evidence is there that the children do in fact, what arguments are there for saying that it children between 10 to 12 should be regarded as having criminal capacity?
Chair, can we respond? I'm going to ask the originator.
Yes, it originated from the Law Commission, and the minimum age of 10 years was a recommendation of them after extensive research and consultations. In arriving at this recommendation, the Commission took into consideration the diverse nature of the South African society, differences in upbringing, maturity, and development. The Commission also took into consideration other factors that play a role in shaping the development of the child, such as culture, rural and urban environments, and socioeconomic and educational factors. The Commission indicated in its report that during its research and consultation, there was significant support for setting the minimum age at 12, but on considering all the above factors, the Commission was convinced that the minimum age be set at 10 years. And, so that was the very solidly on the Commission's recommendation that lifted from 7 to 10 within the specific research they did with the search, the situation of children in South Africa. So we can look in various countries and you can find 10s and you can find 12s and you can find 18s. And also when you raise the age, you raise the age where children can be used by adults to commit crime, and the departments are currently putting indicators in place, and there's preliminary findings, but I don't think we want to say it in public yet. But yeah, so those are some of the issues surrounding this. And then also we must remember we've had submissions from other stakeholders who said they want to keep it at 7. They don't even want to raise it to 10. So the debate goes both ways.
We take JJ, and then I'd like to hear from Jackie afterwards.
I mean, was it the year of that Law Commission report? And then I think also just for the record, really, look, please, you know, I was also looking out on that point. It was the South African Catholic Bishops' Conference. So it was only one submission. I don't know if there were others. And they themselves, when they were confronted on it in the hearing, basically watered it all down. So let's be clear on that. And I think it goes to an issue of, I mean, the argument that we were given was that, okay, the Law Commission might have said that in, when was it, 2000 or what year? 2000, okay, which is 8 years ago. Since then, there have been developments. It's an issue, really, I think, for me, of a psychological one, of does the child understand what he or she is doing? That's what capacity is about. That's why I prefer the question of the word capacity, because I know what it means rather than responsibility. Does a child of 11 understand what's right and what is wrong to the same extent that an adult does? That's the question.
And
have the capacity to make the choice. So I think it is a psychological argument that we've got to look at more than anything else.
Yeah, take Jackie and then JB.
Yeah, thank you. This is the one area where there's quite diverse views across civil society. So, I mean, I really would like all the members, and I'm sure you will, look at all the different submissions. But I do think, you know, the Child Justice Alliance went with the Law Commission's recommendation based on the fact that at that various reasons about our mandate at that stage, the Alliance had agreed on 10. But yes, international law has developed. Developing countries are setting higher minimum ages of criminal capacity. And very much linked to what Mr. Jeffrey said is that there's emerging scientific evidence, medical evidence, which talks about, and please, I'm not a doctor, the frontal lobe development of children and a whole range, and I think Nicro briefly alluded to it, which tends to show that children's capacities do develop older. And I do know that at the time that the Law Commission developed its recommendations, this type of information was not widely available, and it's constantly evolving. So I think that there are changing circumstances if the committee wants to now consider a higher age than what was originally recommended by the Law Reform Commission.
JV, and then back to Dr. Lowe and Bulelani thereafter.
You know, when you think about Roman law and the like, and you realize that the age of majority was 21 years, children becoming a major at 21. Now the trend is that the year should be lowered, because I think the fact that they mature earlier, they are exposed to various things, and they sort of, I would say, take responsibility. A child of 18 years sometimes has completed matric and is working and all that. Now it doesn't need the consent of the parent to do some of the things. Now, if you look at then the capacity or the criminal responsibility, I would have expected that the year should also be lowered, not instead be taken up to 12 years. In other words, I would say the child will be responsible at a lower age than at a higher age.
Thank you, Chair. I just also wanted to make the point that in this debate, and in the point Mr. Jeffries made about the cognitive and everything that should be taken into account, the point is that if you now put it at 10 where the bill suggests, then the category between 10 and 14, there's a rebuttable presumption. So it's not taken that that child, and some of the factors that you look at to determine whether that child has criminal capacity is in Section 9, and it's the educational level, the cognitive ability, domestic and environmental circumstances, age and maturity of such child. So we're not putting children between 10 and 14 out there and say, the law now, you've come. So all those factors, that's just some of the factors. So. Yeah, I just wanted to make that point in this whole debate around raising the age, not to say we're not catering for that rebuttable presumption very clearly.
Bulelani, you're happy. Other members, Imam? Happy? Okay, then we'll just add, and then I'll just give JJ a chance as well, because he feels strongly about it.
Yeah. No, I just want to raise some questions. I don't personally have a strong view. Okay, let's deal with the point JB's making. It's a useful point. He's arguing that actually the age of majority has been brought down because it's discovered that as we grow, we mature at the age of 18, possibly, rather than the age of 21. But you see, it may well be possible that people mature proportionately. So in other words, you mature slower between birth and maybe 4. And then the pace at which you mature may get faster between the ages of 4 and 12. And then it gets yet faster at the age of 12 and 18. And then gets very fast between 18 and 21. So the gap between being 18 and 21 may be smaller in terms of maturity than the gap between somebody who's 10 and 12. I'm not a scientist. I'm just saying theoretically that could be a reply, which I'm sure intellectually you'll agree with, but neither you nor I are scientists. So the fact that you can bring the maturity age down from 21 to 18 doesn't necessarily follow that it should be brought down from 12 to 10. I'm just engaging with you intellectually. I'm not saying you're right or I'm right. I don't know. But the second point is that presumably when the United Nations says 12, it's talking about what it thinks is a universal norm. And as things go, it implies, certainly in Sweden and Germany and France, 12-year-olds are regarded as mature enough to take responsibility stroke capacity for crime. But the subtext is that somehow people of color, or African people in particular, black people in particular, have a different capacity. It is almost like a racial, maybe cultural undertone to it. It implies that Europeans, well, they mature at the age of 12. And people who are of African descent are somehow superior and mature at the age of 10. That's a subtext one can draw from it. And so somehow black people are superior to whites, in other words. We mature at the age of 10, others mature at the age of 12. I'm just extrapolating from the argument, actually. If the United Nations is saying 12, it's saying it's universal, and if countries in Europe are using 12, and they have, children are mature at 12, why are we saying that African children are mature at the age of 10? That's the question I'm throwing out to people. I really don't have a view on this thing. Initially, I thought I agreed with 12. I don't really know, and it's too early to expect. Well, me, I can't speak for others to know. So I think we really must have a proper discussion. Then if you look at the actual section on page 6 of EL, it says here that since 2000, right, how many people are we really talking about? It is evident that cases involving children younger than 12 years occur rarely. So what are the factual situations? I don't know. It's evident the cases involving children younger than 12 years occur rarely. And then this is the point Nicro makes, I think Jackie's covered, on the top of page 7. Based on scientific and medical research, brain development, it says. Actually, it says brain development starts, it says. Brain development starts, note, at the age of 12 and stops at the age of 22 years. Now, the latter is making sense to me about myself, actually. I'm not really going to. And, JJ, I make the same jokes now, if you're really interested to know. Then I used to when I was at the University of Durban Westfield. Yeah. All right. Now the next thing is the SAHRC says in 6.1, it would like to commend the inclusion of the 18 to 20 year olds in the bill, as this is in line with recommendation of the UN committee. I think it's very good. Although I was less impressed with this 21 thing, eh? JB, you see what it says there. I was just impressed with it. But on the issue of 12, I really would like to hear JJ more, personally, and others, yeah. Bulgari also seems 12, yeah. Let's hear. I'd like
to agree, but I just want to argue.
No, you are assuming, Charlotte, I want 12.
Sorry?
You are assuming that I will be in favor of JJ.
Oh, I just want to see
Yes, indeed, Chair, I think we must strongly consider at 12 years, because I think there's a tendency to view crime in terms of contact crimes. Contact crimes, rape, murder, and all, but crime is much more broader than that. Children can be found guilty, for instance, for internet. Those are still criminal offenses. And you can't expect, for instance, a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old child to understand the implications of such complex criminal offenses, but they remain criminal offenses. So let us not limit ourselves only to issues of violent contact crimes. Let's look at crime broadly and try to determine the capacity or the criminal capacity in that sense. So I would in that instance, I want to agree with JJ, because I think there are other criminal offences that can be committed, which might be more complex.
Okay.
Sorry, JJ, I'll come to you in a moment. My personal sense is 12 as well, simply because I feel if the rest of the world affords a child under 12 that protection, call it, of not holding them to be criminally capable, then why should we not afford them the same protection? But, so I'm going for 12.
My reply would be, in Sweden, what crime do they have? In this country, we have horrendous crime, including Bulalani JJ, from children who are 12. Is my assumption correct? If so, can people first, before you come in, because I'd like you to reply to that, and Bulalani, is it true that we get lots of crime, age 12, and so on, under?
Here, let me give you some statistics. What you see the trend is from, and this is a SAP statistics, numbers of children that have been arrested. Between 7 and 13, you're getting numbers like 860 per month. Between 14 and 17, it goes up to 10,000 rand on 10,000 children per month, average. We'll present this later so that you can have it further on. But also when you look at the correctional service statistics, under the ages of 12, 13 years, whether they be for, and these are the three top crimes that you get, economic crimes, usually socioeconomic related, aggressive crimes, which is more contact, and then the sexual offenses, and then narcotics and substance abuse. Under 13 years, the numbers will be on average 2, 3, 4. But as soon as you start getting from the ages of 14 upwards, that's when you're seeing the big shooter. And that's the same with the arrest statistics as well, between 14 years and above. At the same time, I must also premise this against the backdrop of more children being used by adults. And it doesn't really matter what age group it is. So that's one of the issues that are coming through. And you'll find that, and I think with some of the QBAC studies, and we're trying to, through the Department of Social Development, we're doing the kinds of assessments to get more information, because we hadn't ever collected information of that nature where children are used by adults. At least 40 to 50% of matters that are coming through are in cases where children are used by adults. That's something that we're incorporating into all programs at the moment to try and elicit that figure. Also, the other social phenomena that's affecting us, and again, we don't have the statistical research to say it, but our experts and people who are working with it are seeing the trends of the number of child-headed households are just on the increase, and it's impacting in so many ways. And impacting on aggressive crime, because there are no life skills, there are no adults, there are no communities, and not everybody comes from the typical environment of a mom and a dad and the proper community structure. It's highly dysfunctional. And young children are having to take responsibility and not necessarily having the life skills to be able to manage the household, plus also not having the socioeconomic kind of conditions. So that's beginning to infiltrate and affect us. And I think in the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to see the trends changing completely with the stats that we get from aggressive and sexual offenses as well as economic crime. So it's almost conflicting with each other, but that's where you're seeing the trend changing. 14 upwards is a big massive change.
Basically, it's interesting. Is he facilitating, JJ? Because then he's closed that issue. Unless you're speaking about it, there's four things that derive from what you're saying, so you're looking irritated.
Yeah.
All right, fine, speak, then I'll come back and raise things. But remember, a chair should not apologize for facilitating. and if you can show me I'm not facilitating, I'll show you the four questions asking deriving directly from what you're saying, but you go ahead.
Look, I don't know. I think what I just wanted to say, maybe it's also facilitation, even though I'm not chairing. I think the issue, I mean, any child that can walk can be used to commit a crime. A toddler, maybe it's a bit far-fetched, but go take these drugs and go and give them to X down the road. I mean, toddler's a bit far-fetched, but definitely a 7, 8-year-old. Break into a house, you can fit through the windows. Go and bring me these items. The smaller, the better. I think the issue for me is really a scientific one. We need to, there can be emotions in involved in this. But scientifically, do 10, 11-year-olds
have the capacity to understand what they're doing? Or are we actually, if we're starting to hold them responsible, are we actually being unfair to them? Are we being wrong? And I think it's a scientific question, really, that's the key issue. Obviously, that's then informed by what happens in the rest of the world. And I think the fact, Chair, that Uganda is one of the countries. Uganda with its child soldiers of presumably 10-year-olds in the Lord's Resistance Army killing people. But yet they considered 12 as the appropriate age. But I think for me it's really a question of what's the scientific evidence regarding the capacity of people to of children that age to understand. The second issue then is what happens. You can get some pretty nasty little buggers at 8, 9, 10, 11, whatever. What happens to them? And because I think one doesn't want a situation as with South America where the age of capacity was, 18, 16, 18,
sure.
And the result then is people take the law into their own hands and start killing street kids, for example. You want a situation where, let's say, you've got a shopkeeper in an area and some little buggers are coming around and stoning the shop, and the shopkeeper wants action taken. And they must get action, otherwise they're going to go and beat up those kids, or worse, to them. So it's not a question of criminal capacity in that regard. It's a question of maybe those children don't have the criminal capacity to understand what they're doing. My worry is Clause 7 of the bill, a manner of dealing with child below age of 10. And maybe while everybody's sort of here, because I think it's a sort of different issue, is this really adequate? My worry with this section is obviously there's no admissions of guilt or anything like that. The probation officer calls this meeting, and their action plan is a written plan is drawn up appropriate to the child and relevant to the circumstances, and requirements for that plan. But now, given the person, the child, doesn't have criminal capacity, this is 10, age 10 and younger. If we do go up to 12, then it would be 12 and younger. They don't have the criminal capacity. Can they actually be covered by this bill? I think things need to happen, but really what I'm asking is this the right place? And I think particularly to social development, I don't know the Children's Act that's just been passed. But is it not more appropriate, and we could do it in this bill, but it would probably be then amending the Children's Act, not putting something here, that should there not be, you need a procedure that is going to be enforceable. So sure, there's no criminal capacity on the part of, let's talk about 10 years, because that's what we've got so far. There's no criminal capacity, but you need something to happen to them where they are looked after, where they are... assisted, dealt with, whatever the word is, so that the problem does not reoccur. Because if the problem reoccurs, that will then lead to people taking the law into their own hands. Is it the right place for it to be here, or should it not be in the Children's Act? And I don't know, children's court, placing them in a home, that kind of thing. So, Chair, that's an additional question I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to sort of raise it now while everybody is here. But I think in short, I don't know about Eunice's 4 points, but I think for me the capacity age issue is really has to be a scientific thing, and one can then also look at the international norms. But it's a scientific thing that we've got to be convinced of. And none of us, we might have 12-year-old kids, but none of us, or 11-year-old kids, but none of us actually really know scientifically. That kid might be different to another kid. How old's Macau?
Yeah, it's all very useful. But now to come back to where I was. No, it is very useful. See, deriving from what you're saying, four quick things. One is, you see, if we are to arrive at some assessment of 10 to... It would be useful to know, of the 860 people, how many of them are between 10 to 12. That's the first point, right? Secondly, I'm not sure... I really think... Based on what you're saying, you keep sliding in statistics here and there. We need to talk over lunch, because I really think some of the things we're discussing should only follow on a better understanding of the empirical picture. And I'm not sure why you haven't badgered me
to say, look, we've got all the statistics that will help you. And when we're going to do it, Carol, JJ, and I have to decide. Because you might want to present all your statistics early this afternoon, so it will assist us. The third thing is, you speak about child-headed households. Now, this means you say that people are not having parents around to guide them. This means they are more vulnerable to doing criminal work and so on. And that in itself reinforces JJ's argument that actually, therefore, given the vulnerabilities, JB, that they should actually be 12 on the one hand. But on the other hand, being a facilitator, and I'm being fair, unlike people presenting positions, let's not mention who they are. On the other hand, what I read in the CJA type submissions is precisely because we have so many children who are, because of HIV, AIDS, and so on, being household head, it is difficult to put them in prison because the consequences are, or some detention, that their 8-year-old brothers and sisters are left abandoned and so on. So it cuts both ways. And then the final point is the point that JJ does in fact make, right? Fifth point, I wasn't four, it was five when I wrote them down. You say that one of the issues that arose was adults using children. But in the submissions that I read over this weekend, one of them says that that is now catered for by an act that was passed last year, the Children's Act or something, which now makes it very clear that if a child is used by an adult, it's doubly offensive. Yeah, it's a statute of offenses, my friend says here. And then the sixth point, which occurred to me while JJ was speaking, was that NICRO does say that mental age only grows at 12. And if we say that it grows at 10, somehow we're implying that African children in South Africa, or children in South Africa generally, are superior. They grow at an earlier age. You know, there's almost like a racial or cultural connotation to it, which is something a facilitator must throw out for people to think about. Whether it's correct or not, I don't know. And the final thing is also to say, you see, for me, let me be upfront. Now, this is where I'm not facilitating. I'm not speaking like JJ was speaking. I am saying my view was 12 should be appropriate. Instinctively, I'm guided by that. Not because I'm a sentimentalist or anything. Not because I'm an idealist. It just seemed right. And the same point he makes about Uganda. I thought about the child warriors and so on. But the point also is that, you see, for me, I've become less keen, JJ, since Sunday night on 12. Because I think it's a package as a whole. And because we're now going for assessment for all, and because we're taking the line we are on preliminary inquiry, and because we are even possibly moving in a direction we are on divergence, I just feel it doesn't matter as much to me now as it did 48 hours ago, whether it's 10 or 12. But if you ask me to make a choice, I don't know. If you insisted that I'd say 12, I'm 50.5% for 12. But that's now a contribution, it's not facilitation. And it's lunchtime, so maybe we can give them and then tie up.
Yeah, just,
Dr. Delport, then. Jay, we're really making heavy weather about something that has no practical consequences. If you say 10, what happens with 11, 12, 13, 14 years old? They've got to be proved to have criminal capacity. The prosecutor must, and it says specifically in the Act, must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So, if you look at what must be proved, then most prosecutors will simply throw in the towel and not even attempt to prove that a 12-year-old, even a 13-year-old. So whether we make it 10 or 12 or 7, it does not really affect.
No, but if you read the submissions of the Delport, they are very clear. They are given by lawyers like yourself who say that where you have rebuttable presumption, Professor Slot says, actually, in practice, it doesn't work. They set out the argument, Jackie, is that right?
No.
There's at least four submissions that say, yes, you can argue what you're arguing, but they reply. What you must do is reply to them. They've presented arguments in their submissions.
Chairperson, it's correct if the rebuttable presumption was the other way around. In other words, you are criminally responsible unless proved. But if you say you are not responsible unless proved, it does not really make any difference.
Serena, if you're going to be quick, otherwise, let's
wait until everybody is back later this afternoon to take up this discussion, because I don't think we're going to finish it within the next 5 minutes.
I need to be 2:30.
Well, then when JJ
same
venue.
We shall break and then.
Yeah, the lunch is here in M block, wherever that is.
Mark's
building, yeah.
2:30. But I'll
hold it back until 3 years later.